It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 534 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, February 11th, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. This is Valentine's Day week. What a stupid holiday. I mean, come on, let's be honest here. Valentine's is a stupid holiday. If you're not in a relationship, it makes you feel like shit. If you are in a relationship, now you're all stressed out because you got to figure out, well, what am I going to do for Valentine's Day? It's not a birthday. It's not an anniversary. It's just some random holiday. Plus, you got this weird baby with wings wearing nothing but a diaper shooting arrows at people. It's a stupid holiday. Anyway, the Super Bowl last weekend, that was quite the Netflix drop with that Cloverfield movie. If you want to know my thoughts on that, that's up on the YouTube channel for those who haven't already seen it. Put a little spoilerish movie review up on the YouTube channel. Seems to be pretty well received. We'll see. Maybe I'll do more of that in the future. Although I don't go as crazy about most things as I do the Cloverfield franchise, because it just drives me nuts what they've done with it. So anyway, that's up there if you want to hear something non-wrestling related for a change. Audible, keep taking advantage of our 30-day trial. Get yourself a free book, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Don't forget to take advantage of that. And we have two new shirts going up in the Pro Wrestling Tee store this week. Well, actually, technically, it's one shirt, two different designs, one black, one white. So that should be going up in the next few days in our store on PWTs. It's been a while since we've had a new design up there. This one is sort of, I guess, WrestleMania-themed, in a way. I'll leave it at that. And keep on supporting the podcast if you would like to do so. TheSalaMonster.com, PayPal button's on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. John Luzcana Lopez, it wouldn't feel right if I didn't mention his name up front, thank you. Deadpool, James Herrera, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, the Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, The Dark Serpent, Derek Gibbs, Yvonne Bruiser Balak. Man, those last half a dozen names or so that I just rattled off, that's the old school crew right there. All the way back to the very beginning. Raymond the Mountie Medina, Massgrave, Micah Harshaw, Faith, Hard Knocks, Harvey, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Show Off, Corey Van Dam, The Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T, The Demon Temptress, Samantha Krasinski, The Belgian Brute, Nicholas Overmeer, The Prince of Wales, Nicholas George, No Way Out, Nick Fudgett, Hard Times, Hank Spaulding, Young Million, thank you. Anthony Blythe, I hope you're doing okay, my friend, hang in there. Jimmy the Mailman Milstead, who wants to give a shout out to Cordell Mitchell in the Facebook group. There was a little flare up recently, but all is well. All is well now, and Jimmy wanted to give him a shout, so that was very nice of him to do. And the Burning Star, John Mahoney, who takes care of his mother, the main water pipe in their home just burst. Right now they can't shower, they can't wash things, it's a terrible situation. So they're trying to raise money for repairs. If you'd like to help, you can find, they have a campaign up right now on GoFundMe. You can go to GoFundMe.com and just search Mother's Plumbing Emergency. The campaign should come right up. It should be the first thing. So if you have the means to do so and would like to help out a fellow listener, you can certainly go ahead and do that. I'm sure John would appreciate that. The New Japan New Beginning in Osaka show took place yesterday. I have not yet had a chance to watch it. I had it all queued up on my New Japan World subscription, but there was just, I had way too much work to do and just not enough time to do it in. So I've heard a lot about two matches in particular, the Will Ospreay-Hiromu Takahashi match, which I've seen mostly really positive feedback for, but there were some of you who said you got to watch this match because I don't know how I feel about it, or they did too much, or I didn't like it, it took me out of it. And it's a Will Ospreay match. I can only imagine how polarizing it will be. So I want to watch that, and I want to watch the main event, which was Okada against Sonata, which apparently was a great match. A great Okada main event, you don't say. So I do plan on watching at least those two, if not the entire card. The one thing I did see, and the big news coming out of the show, was the Rey Mysterio video. There was a video that aired with Rey Mysterio challenging Jushin Thunder Liger to a match at the New Japan Strong Style Evolve show in Long Beach, which is coming up next month, March 25th. It's already sold out. Rey said that this would be his first match ever in New Japan Pro Wrestling, which stunned me when I heard that. I guess I just sort of assumed that he had been through there at some point, but I guess not. And he's had a pretty long career. He's wrestled all over the place. I guess this will be the first time, though, for NJPW. Liger was doing commentary, Japanese commentary for the show when this aired. And as soon as the video ended, they went to him, and he immediately accepted the challenge. So the match is on. This is going to be their first match in over 20 years. Their last match, and as far as I know, their only match, took place all the way back at Starrcade in WCW back in 1996. I did watch that match yesterday. Somebody linked to it on Twitter, and so I just watched it, and it was good. It wasn't great. And maybe I'm just thinking back to some of Ray's other matches, like the one he had in 97 with Eddie. I mean, Ray had a lot of great matches in WCW back then. And, you know, considering who was involved, I was thinking, man, this may be the greatest thing I've seen in ages. And it was actually a little disappointing. I expected more, given that both these guys, who they are, and them being 20 years younger. I actually think that these two could have a better match in Long Beach next month than the one they had at Starrcade. I mean, they may be older, but they're smarter. Ray looked fantastic, I thought, at the Royal Rumble. Liger, we know, can still go. You get two vets in the ring together for a big match like that, maybe the last time they'll ever be in the ring together, I think they're going to put on a show. Now, that show is airing live here in the States on Access TV, which I don't have, but I'll find some way to watch it. I have a New Japan World subscription, but that's not going to do me a lot of good since this is, in this country, my understanding is it's airing as an exclusive live on Access. It may be archived after the fact on New Japan World for us, but if you want to watch it live, the only way to do so is going to be on Access. That's just the sort of arrangement that they have to make sure more people watch on Access, because if people have New Japan World, they probably just watch there. Internationally, my understanding is probably is going to air on New Japan World. So if you live in the UK, if you live in Australia and you're worried about that, you should be fine. I think this is only for those of us here in the US. But that's going to be a big show. And as far as how this might affect Ray going back to WWE, because there's been some interviews that he's done where he's been very complimentary of them. He's even given the indication that he expects to go back, maybe not full time. But, you know, sign some sort of deal and go back and do more matches in WWE. The way that he's been talking, he's been very optimistic about that. I don't think this changes that at all. Just like Chris Jericho working a match in New Japan doesn't mean that he's excommunicated, right, from coming back to WWE. I don't think they would do that to Ray either. So I don't really think it affects that at all. I think he could absolutely still come back and probably will come back to WWE to do more matches. It just may be a little bit delayed. I don't think they've worked anything out yet, but they were very impressed by the reaction he got and how he looked. And apparently the YouTube video that they put of him making his return at the Rumble, it's done something crazy like 12 or 13 million views on YouTube, which is insane. It kind of reminds me of when the Hardys came back at WrestleMania last year. I don't know what that video is up to now. By now, it may be like 25 or 30 million. It did crazy. It did like 5 million views in the first few days. It was far and above anything else they had put up on the YouTube channel from Mania. So there's a lot of interest. You know, when you go away for a while, they say absence makes the heart grow fonder. It's true. It really is true, because there was a time when I was, you know, pretty sick of seeing Rey Mysterio, and he wasn't really doing much. He was getting hurt all the time. I figured, man, he just keeps getting hurt with his knee. How much longer can this guy go on? He's at the end of his rope here. And then he left. And he wasn't wrestling as much. I mean, he was still wrestling a good amount, you know, in Mexico and other places. But he wasn't doing that full-time WWE schedule. He was able to keep his own schedule and wrestle as often or as infrequently as he felt comfortable. He was in Lucha Underground for a while. I haven't heard any stories about a Rey Mysterio knee injury in years. Whereas before, you would think the guy was made of glass when he was in WWE, but it's been a very long time since I've heard about him either having, re-injuring his knee or needing some kind of surgery. He's been able to keep himself pretty healthy. And so you look at this whole New Japan thing. First Jericho, now Rey. I guess it's the cool thing now to sort of drop in for a match or two in New Japan. But I hope he does come back in some form to WWE part-time, just to do a few big matches during the year. If for no other reason, I hope he comes back, signs with SmackDown. Because Rey Mysterio against AJ Styles needs to happen at least once in a WWE ring. I know they had one match a couple of years back. I think it was, what was that promotion in the UK? Five Star Wrestling, who I think has their own, weekly 2 or 3 hour TV show now over there. So they've wrestled at least that one time before, but never in WWE. That's a match I'd like to see. And look, if the match with Liger goes well, just like Jericho, the match with Omega went great. He's decided to stick around for the match with Naito eventually. Maybe Rey does the same. If Rey has fun and everything goes great and he's received well and they feel, hey, this guy could be good for business and help move some tickets, we may see more of him in New Japan. I wouldn't mind seeing Mysterio against somebody like Will Ospreay. Those two had a really good match for the What Culture promotion last year. Mysterio against someone like Kushida. That's another match I'd love to see. So all Rey has to do is just keep staying healthy. Just stay healthy. And for him, that's always been the challenge. But lately, he's done pretty good with that. Part-time here and there, big matches. I think that's the way to go. Now, I mentioned Jericho before. His match with Naito, it sounds like nothing's confirmed or anything, but it looks like that match will probably take place at the New Japan Dominion show in June, which is kind of a big show they do every year. And that was my call back on episode 529. If you remember, I did my whole prediction show for 2018. And I said, one of the predictions that I threw out there was that the Jericho-Naito match wasn't going to happen until June. It was going to happen on that Dominion show. And it looks like that probably will be the case. I mean, look, there's no reason now to have this match on the same card with Mysterio next month. Mysterio, that's a big enough attraction to sort of, keep people excited on his own. Plus, the show's already sold out. What are you really getting out of it? Why do you have to stockpile that show? Save it for Japan. So this whole Booker T, Corey Graves thing was exposed by them yesterday on Booker's radio show. The whole thing was a ruse. My only regret here is that they beat me by one day. I was hoping to come on here and tell everybody. And just tell everybody just to just not even worry about this because this is all nonsense. And then they just beat me to it and they revealed that the whole thing was in fact just all nonsense. But that didn't stop people from running with it like it was some kind of a big deal. I'm sure you're all aware. Booker went on his show last week. He went on this very calm rant of sorts against Corey Graves and made it seem like Corey. Actually, he outright said that Corey was the reason he was no longer on the Raw announce team. Had nothing to do with Jonathan Coachman or anything like that. It was all Corey Graves' fault. And he's not going to, do anything to Corey Graves on the job, at the office, so to speak. But if he ever sees Corey Graves in the street, he's going to beat his ass. And everybody was figuring, what happened between Booker T and Corey Graves? Oh, Booker T, what a terrible thing to say about a fellow employee. He should be fired and all this other nonsense, blah, blah, blah. And so Booker, and by the way, also in that whole thing, he was challenging Graves to a match at WrestleMania, which of course Graves can't be cleared to wrestle, so that whole thing was ridiculous. There was never any end game there. So Booker said, look, I'll have Corey on my show. Call into my show, we'll air it all out, and Corey called in, and they had a nice laugh about it. And they were more amazed that this thing got picked up, which is kind of embarrassing. By actual mainstream news outlets, got picked up by Forbes, got picked up by USA Today. Graves said he was getting tons of text messages from people, like colleagues, people in the company, people in the business, wondering what the hell's going on? What happened between you two? Big E didn't know what was going on. They had to fill him in that, no, everything's fine. And that's when Big E said, hey, well, can I joke about it on TV? And that's why Big E kind of made a crack about it on SmackDown on Tuesday. Michael Cole. They even fooled Michael Cole. Michael Cole went over to Graves. He's like, what the hell's going on with you and Booker? And then when they told him what it was, that it was nothing, you know, Cole was like, well, what's the end game here? And Corey said, well, there is no end game here. It's like, there is no end game. We're just fucking around. There's no end game. So even Cole didn't quite know what the hell was going on here. But it was a case where Booker just had time to fill at the end of his show last week on his show. He didn't know what to talk about. And so he said, well, why don't we just screw around and I'll talk about Corey Graves. And the whole thing caught fire and took off like it was some kind of big scandal. Now, Booker said on his show yesterday, he was actually happy. He was legitimately happy when he found out that he was being replaced and sent back to the kickoff panels, which is what he was doing before. He admitted, look, I'm not an announcer. He says, I'm good in the analyst role on the kickoff shows. That's what I'm good at. I enjoy that. You know, I wasn't born to be an announcer. He said he recognizes his role as a utility player for the company. He can fill whatever role they need him to fill. You know, he's always on call to do whatever they need him to do. I mean, look, one of the reasons that I thought this whole thing was ridiculous from the word go, you know, Booker has his own promotion, The Reality of Wrestling, which is down in Houston, and he does a very good job with that. I know he's very passionate about that. And that could be a foot in the door. You know, those guys and gals who come through there, you know, let's say there's somebody who comes in and Booker says, wow, you know, this person can go somewhere. I'm sure Booker can put a good word in with somebody, help him, you know, get a foot in the door in some way, right? Booker has a good relationship, obviously, with the company and those in charge. And I just thought to myself, like, why would he put that in jeopardy? Why would he? It just didn't make any sense that people weren't questioning it for that reason, if nothing else. You know, Booker's not a stupid man. I don't think he would ever do anything to jeopardize that. But the idea that he would even seriously threaten to beat up an employee of the company that he works for on the air. It's not like this is like a rumor. Oh, Booker T's going around telling people he's going to beat up Corey Graves. He was pretty clear about it on his show last week. And the fact that he would do that and people actually took that seriously, and the guy would put his job in jeopardy like that, that should have been a tip-off from the word go. So whatever, they had some fun with it. It's over now. I think the best thing that Booker T ever did in that role as Raw announcer was shove Michael Cole into Braun Strowman a few weeks ago. And if anything, he should have gotten a promotion for that. Raw was live from Des Moines, Iowa last Monday. We now have 5 of the 6 slots filled in the Men's Elimination Chamber match. Miz beat Apollo Crews. Miz, by the way, just signed a new 4-year deal, so he's not going anywhere. Not that anybody expected Miz to jump to New Japan or Impact. Probably the last thing anybody would have expected. But Miz is going to stick around for at least another 4 years with the company. So he beat Apollo Crews to qualify, and I know it's hard to believe. I know this is very difficult for people to understand, but Roman Reigns pinned Bray Wyatt to qualify for the Elimination Chamber match. I know. I can't believe it either. Stunning. Absolutely stunning. Add to that, Elias in the main event here pinned John Cena in a triple threat match that also included attempted murder of Braun Strowman. So Elias, by virtue of that win, has earned the right to be the final entrant into the Elimination Chamber match. So it's a pretty safe bet that Elias will be giving us a concert from inside one of the chamber pods during that match. So we've got Reigns, Cena, Strowman, Elias, and Miz all confirmed for the Elimination Chamber, with the final spot being determined tomorrow night in what they are calling a second chance fatal four-way, which is really just a fancy way of saying the 4 losers from the earlier qualifying matches who couldn't hack it. We're going to give them a second chance to right their wrong. Finn Balor, Apollo Crews, Bray Wyatt, and Woken Matt Hardy are the participants in that second chance fatal four-way. You know, Wyatt and Hardy cancel each other out. I'm sure they'll have their own singles match on the next pay-per-view. Maybe some kind of a gimmick match. I don't know if they'll go to the Hardy compound. Maybe they're going to hold off on that for a while and just do some sort of no DQ match, falls count anywhere. I don't know. But I figured those two cancel each other out. And they'll do a gimmick match at the pay-per-view. And if Apollo Crews gets into the Elimination Chamber match, I will go back and I will watch every Jinder Mahal pay-per-view championship match from last year. Okay? It's not happening. Finn Balor will be in the Elimination Chamber, as he should be. So they can either set something up with Miz and Strowman for WrestleMania, which was the rumored match at one point. Remember, Miz was going to defend the Intercontinental title against Strowman to give him something to win. Or if Strowman ends up tagging with Ronda Rousey against Triple H and Stephanie, they could always set something up starting, you know, in the chamber match between Miz and Balor that would build to an IC title match between those two at WrestleMania. Speaking of Ronda Rousey, that brings me to this report in this week's Observer that claims that the real reason WWE signed Ronda Rousey was less about making money with her and more about elevating Stephanie McMahon as a mainstream name. Her financial value to the company, that being Ronda, according to this report, is secondary. It is secondary to the goal of making Stephanie a bigger star to those outside of WWE. Where do I even begin with this? I don't buy for a second that WWE doesn't care whether or not they make money, and that's not really what the report is saying, but I could see people reading that going, oh my God, WWE, they don't care if they make money, they just want to make Stephanie a big star. I don't buy for a second WWE doesn't care about making money with Ronda Rousey, and I'm sure they're paying her a pretty penny too. Okay, of course they do. They are a business. They are in the business of making money. They have a funny way of trying to do that sometimes with the decisions they make. But they are a business and they want to make money. And they do. They make a lot of money. The notion that it would be second fiddle to the main goal of turning Stephanie into a bigger star is completely 100% believable. I have no problem believing that at all. Just look no further than the way they've promoted her on TV. They have promoted this woman as the force behind this women's revolution or evolution or whatever the hell they want to call it. They bill her as a pioneer. Look at the words they use to describe this woman on TV every week. Pioneer. A trailblazer. That's what Michael Cole called her at the Royal Rumble when she was coming out to the ring. A trailblazer. Clyde Drexler was a trailblazer. Stephanie McMahon is not a trailblazer. So you look at the way they talk about her on TV, and yeah, I could absolutely see that as being the main reason they brought in Ronda Rousey. In fact, on Ronda's first night, what was the last shot of her before she went and walked up the ramp? She went to ringside to shake Stephanie. They built this whole tense handshake up between her and Stephanie. Clearly they were setting something up and planting a seed for WrestleMania. I mean, that was obvious from the beginning. So right from the very first appearance, Stephanie is involved. You could see where they're going with this. That was never a surprise. And the belief is that by doing an angle or doing a match with the two of them, they could get exposure similar to the exposure they got with Mike Tyson. Remember Mike Tyson shoved Steve Austin, that great famous angle the night after the Royal Rumble on Raw, where they're in the ring, everybody, there's like Tyson's entire entourage is in the ring, and Vince and Shane and Slaughter, and I think Patterson and Briscoe maybe are in the ring, and here you have Mike Tyson, here you have Steve Austin, and Austin was just awesome. I mean, as a promo, when he would go in on somebody back then, I mean, are you kidding me? 96, 97, 98 Steve Austin on the mic was one of the best in the business, and believable too. And that, I think, is sometimes that's something that they miss, I think, understanding. When I hear stuff like this, like, oh, they want this person to be the next Stone Cold, or they think they can mimic what Austin did with Tyson, and what Austin did with this person and that person, and try to make them a mainstream star. And one of the things you got to remember here is that Steve Austin may be the most relatable star, like superstar, that they have ever had in the history of that company, more so than Hogan. Hogan was a big star. How relatable was he to the everyman? Did Hulk Hogan look like the average man on the street? Hulk Hogan looked like, he looked like a monster. You go back in 85, 86, like at his real peak. You could argue his real true peak was 86, maybe 87. he looked, physically looked like a monster. All those guys did back then. I mean, they all look ridiculous with the colored outfits and the neon colors and the sequin gowns. I mean, I love that. I love that era of wrestling when people stood out and looked that way, but I don't know that you would be able to look at somebody like Hulk Hogan or Andre or Ultimate Warrior or even Macho Man and say, yeah, I could relate to that guy. But Steve Austin, who is one of the biggest names in the history of this business, he came out, his whole shtick was he's the everyman. People could relate to him going after his boss, beating up his boss. Man, I wish I could do that. But he would go out there, he would talk, he would act like the average guy who's just pissed off at the world and pissed off at his boss. People could relate to that. So I think it was a lot easier for people to understand that, to get behind that, to root for him. So I just want to make that point too, because I think that sometimes gets lost. I look at the roster now, I don't see anybody like that. I don't really look at John Cena like that. I don't look at Roman Reigns like that. There's nobody who is, I think, as relatable to the average person, the average male, in this country anyway, than Steve Austin was back then in the late 90s. So that helped in terms of that whole thing working and then the shove on Tyson. And I remember that. It got mainstream exposure that night on all, that whole week. Local newscasts, newspapers. And it was genius because they just wanted to establish the fact that Mike Tyson was going to be at WrestleMania. We still didn't even know what his role was going to be on the show at that point. People thought, after that angle, they thought they were setting up a match. They thought it was going to be Austin against Tyson. I mean, if you were just tuning in that night and watched that, isn't that what you would think? They didn't make the referee announcement until many weeks later. They got exactly what they wanted. They got all they needed was that one night of publicity. And to plant the seed in people's heads, hey, WrestleMania is coming up and you might get to see this match. So that whole thing was brilliant. And that really, in a lot of ways, helped turn that company around from 98 on. I don't want to put that all on Tyson because I think that's sort of an insult to Austin. Because I think Austin ultimately would have been fine on his own even without the Tyson involvement. But that's sort of what they're trying to do here, I guess. That's the idea, is that they would love to be able to in some way replicate that whole dynamic, but do it with Rousey and Stephanie. Same thing, boss-employee dynamic, because Rousey is under contract now. She's a full-time performer. She's not just some celebrity coming in for a match. She now works for Stephanie. She now works for the McMahons. And the fact that they're, you know, thinking about doing this with Stephanie and not Charlotte and not Sasha Banks or someone like that, right? One of their big female stars who they could plug into this and perhaps turn them into a mainstream star. And that goes to the whole thing of, does WWE even really want that, right? Do they want that? Do they want to even create another mainstream star like that who maybe gets too big for their britches and then eventually leaves them, sort of the way The Rock did? He went off to make movies and, you know, and John Cena now is obviously, it's like he's got one foot out the door and he's doing the Today Show and movies. I'm not even sure WWE really wants that, to be honest with you. Not that they don't want their talent to do stuff, you know, that helps get the company some good publicity. But yeah, this is a debate that we've had sometimes before, and I've had people send this question in. Is that era over? Does WWE want so much control and just wants to avoid a situation where they build somebody up for years and years only for them to sort of bail on them because they become bigger than the company, right? Are they almost intentionally, you know, booking these people and writing for them and handling them in such a way where they don't get above a certain level, where everybody sort of is, in a way, on the same level? And you don't have that one big superstar that stands out the way that Hogan and Austin and Rock and people like that did. I don't rule it out. I could see why they wouldn't want somebody to get too big. So I don't know if that's the case here or not. I think it really is just a case of them wanting to get Stephanie over as a big name. And instead of plugging in somebody like a Charlotte or a Sasha, they're going to go with Stephanie. Now, in smaller doses on TV, she's fine. But this does not inspire a whole lot of confidence that they're going to be giving us Stephanie McMahon in smaller doses now, does it? They're looking for an Austin McMahon dynamic. Rhonda is signed, she works for them, and it's only a matter of time now before we get the inevitable Stephanie saying, you work for me now, and that whole thing to probably build to the match at WrestleMania, I assume, the mixed tag. They can try to recreate all the magic they want. Here's the problem with that. And it goes to the whole idea that she's trying to be her father. She's trying to be Vince. Stephanie McMahon, for all of the similarities she may have with her father, she even looks like Vince a little bit. She is not her father. Stephanie is not Vince. She never will be. She never will be Vince McMahon. Stephanie will never be a mainstream star. It's not happening. Vince, at least, you never knew what might happen when he was out there. He'd probably end up going out there and, you know, getting his ass kicked. He'd eat a stunner. He'd get choke slammed or rock bottomed. He once had his face buried in Rikishi's ass. And Stephanie got stink faced once too, many, many, many years ago. Imagine that happening now. Yeah, right. Vince was entertaining though in part because he would always get what he had coming to him. He didn't mind taking one for the team. That's part of what made him so entertaining. The boss would get his ass kicked. We don't get that with Stephanie. Right? Now she's the boss. That's not a bad position to be in, but that's all she is. She is just not a compelling enough character. People are not clamoring to see her on television every single week, like you could say they used to with Vince, because that was a compelling storyline, and Vince is a very unique guy. Put it that way. I think we can all, whatever your opinions are about Vince McMahon, we can at least say that Vince McMahon is a very unique individual, and back when he was really at his peak as that Mr. McMahon character, there was none better. I've said before, I think the Mr. McMahon character is the greatest heel in the history of the business. And there have been a lot of great bad guys, a lot of great villains over the years. Ric Flair, Roddy Piper. You can put other promotions in there as well. I still put the Mr. McMahon character at the top of the list. He, to me, is the greatest heel. He is the greatest villain of all time. Stephanie is not a compelling character the way that her father was, and she never will be. In fact, her character, she makes the show infinitely worse when she hogs the spotlight, not better. If she was entertaining and she made the show better, fine, give her 10 segments. But she's not. And the thing that I kind of find a little bit offensive, and I don't expect any of the women, obviously, to, you know, publicly say this, but this whole notion about them giving her credit on TV constantly for the women's revolution stuff, is, you know, it's a slap in the face to the women, especially the women from NXT, who actually did step up and get people to care more about women's wrestling in that company, who did the legwork, who put that work in. And you can throw Trish and Lita in that argument as well. I know that goes back, you know, a lot of years to a time when I wouldn't exactly call women's wrestling a highlight of the show every single week, and they didn't even really have much of a division. You go back to the mid to late 2000s, and some of the people they were bringing in who just had no business being in the ring. It was not a high point, I think, in that company as far as women's wrestling goes. But, you know, Trish and Lita certainly did a lot to, you know, bring more attention to it. They even headlined some shows, which was unheard of for this company back then, for the women to, you know, be put in a main event position on the show. That was a big deal. And Trish was truly one of the greatest female performers they've ever had. Lita was also good, not as good as Trish. I thought, you know, Lita was kind of sloppy, but, you know, Lita has a lot of fans out there. Lita was over, and Lita was very popular, and she could do moonsaults and all that. Great. So you can include them in the conversation as well. But what about Paige? What about Emma? What about, you know, Charlotte and Sasha and Becky and Bayley when they started pushing them, and they were in those NXT TakeOver matches, and they were really, you know, firing on all cylinders. You know, for all the talk about Sasha and Bayley, and they had a great match especially at that one takeover in Brooklyn. And even Charlotte, we knew Charlotte was going to be pushed as, you know, the queen, literally the queen, that's what they call her, the queen of that division. But, you know, one of the sort of low-key matches that doesn't get talked about, I think, as much, that was, you know, maybe one of the best from that era, from that time, was the one between Sasha and Becky. I forgot which takeover that was. That was a great match. So there was a lot of quality stuff going on. Those women, they created a buzz all on their own that didn't exist before for the women in that company. And call it a storyline, call it whatever you want. I mean, it's not just a storyline. You know, when they put press releases out and they do media and stuff, this is how they refer to Stephanie. This is not just for storyline on TV. These are the words that they use. These are the superlatives that they use to describe Stephanie and how they put her over as though she is some kind of pioneer who is responsible, solely responsible for this evolution, for this revolution that we've seen on TV. And I think it is, in a lot of ways, a slap in the face to the women who had a hell of a lot more to do with that than Stephanie did. It's Stephanie who gets the credit for this. This is the story that they have decided to tell. Once they have their narrative, there's no turning back. Once they have their narrative, they stick to it. But if their goal now is to use Ronda Rousey, a legitimate mainstream star, to get Stephanie McMahon up to that same level, to where one day maybe she too is doing movies the way that Ronda is doing movies now, they're going to be severely disappointed. Kurt Angle announced the first ever Women's Elimination Chamber match lineup. Alexa Bliss will defend her Raw Women's title against Sasha Banks, Bayley, Mickey James, Mandy Rose, and Sonya Deville. And meanwhile, Nia Jax will challenge Asuka. And if Nia wins, not only is Asuka's undefeated streak over, the title match at WrestleMania becomes a three-way. And they made it sound like the decision had already been made, that Asuka's going to be challenging Alexa or whoever for the Raw Women's title and not for the SmackDown Women's title. Now, Asuka has never actually made her decision. We were never told that Asuka had picked one over the other. It just seemed very presumptuous on their part that, well, we assume that Asuka's going to be challenging for the Raw Women's title, and I'm assuming that plays into the whole, you know, storyline. They're just trying to convince everybody that the decision's already been made, and they're going to surprise everybody when, in the end, Asuka picks Charlotte to go after for the SmackDown Women's title. At least I hope that's the direction this is going in, because that's the match I think people want to see the most. Now, last week I said that Alexa was going to eke out a win and retain her championship in the Chamber match. That was my prediction. I'm now looking at this thinking, and I still believe that, by the way, but I think that match probably goes on before the Asuka Nia Jax match. So we'll get the Women's Chamber. I don't know if it's going to open the show, but we'll get that match first. Then the Asuka Jax match will come later. And after Alexa's already won and retained her championship, she comes out, and we know that there's a relationship there, right? A friendship between Alexa and Nia. She's going to want to go out of her way to try to, you know, help her friend. Or maybe not. Because if you really think about it, if you think about who Alexa Bliss is, that whole character on TV, even though she came out to help Mickie James save Mickie from a beatdown on Raw Monday, and that sort of weirded everybody out, what's Alexa doing? Is she going babyface? Of course not. The story they're trying to tell is that Alexa Bliss knows she's really in deep shit, right? Going into this Chamber match, she's outnumbered. The odds are against her retaining her championship. Nobody likes her. She's been a bitch to everybody. And now she's going to be locked inside this structure with these women. She's trying to ingratiate herself. She's trying to create some alliances and get some people on her side, right? It's very obvious what they're doing there, even though I think in the end she'll eke out a win. So she comes out, presumably to help Nia provide the distraction, but she, quote, accidentally ends up costing Nia the match with Asuka. So Asuka can beat Nia while you're still trying to, you know, keep Nia strong in a way. You know, I don't think they're just going to have Asuka go in there and just submit her clean in the middle of the ring. This allows her to save face a little bit if, let's say, Alexa comes out and distracts her, if Alexa comes out and tries to interfere on her behalf, but it backfires, it leads to her losing. Asuka's streak is kept intact. Alexa's feigning, oh, you know, she's all disappointed. She's shocked. She can't believe what happened. She's so sorry, even though she's not. Then the next night on Raw, or maybe on SmackDown that Tuesday, Asuka makes it very clear that she's decided to go after the SmackDown Women's title. She's going to challenge Charlotte for the championship at WrestleMania, and that then paves the way for Nia to challenge Alexa for the Raw Women's title, which I'm sure Kurt Angle will be more than happy to do, because now the Elimination Chamber's over. They don't have any other way to determine a number one contender, and if Nia effectively gets screwed at that pay-per-view, I'm sure it'll make Kurt Angle a lot more likely to reward her with a championship match. And that sets up Nia and Alexa for WrestleMania, which will probably end up being very similar to the China Ivory match from WrestleMania 17. Maybe not quite that one-sided, but I see Nia and Alexa being more of a squash than a competitive match. So that's how I think things are going to be set up. Plus, you could still do Sasha Banks against Bayley on the undercard at WrestleMania as a singles match, like I also suggested last week. You throw in whatever match Ronda Rousey is going to be in. That's four women's matches on the WrestleMania card right there. And you have to think that there's going to be some sort of a tag match or a battle royal to get the other women on that show. So we could end up potentially with five different women's matches at WrestleMania this year. Asuka beat Bayley. They had a good match here on this show. Popped off a sweet-looking flying armbar for the tap out. Bayley shook hands with her after the match. Didn't look too happy about it. It was supposed to be Seth Rollins and Jason Jordan against Sheamus and Cesaro for the Raw Tag Team titles, but Jordan hurt his neck, we were told, doing bridges in the back. And Rollins was not happy about this. He ended up teaming with Roman Reigns, pulling double duty on this show after his big win over Bray Wyatt. Now, Jordan did come out. He was rooting on Rollins and Reigns. He even got involved in the match behind the referee's back, tried to help him win. Roman got mad at him, told him to leave. Sheamus and Cesaro got into a bit of trouble, so they went to go leave. They grabbed their belts. They were going to walk out. Jordan steps in their way. They go to punch Jason Jordan. Jordan fights back, punches them. Referee sees this, calls for the DQ. He has disqualified Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins. And Rollins is just infuriated by this. And then backstage, he goes up to Jordan, who's standing there with Kurt Angle, and Rollins calls him a selfish son of a bitch. Some partner, huh? Jordan hurts his neck. His partner's out there blaming him, calling him an SOB. Angle tells his son to leave. Don't come back until you're medically cleared. The irony of Kurt Angle, of all people, yelling at somebody to leave and not come back until they're medically cleared from their neck injury. The irony was not lost on me. As it turns out, this was something of a semi-shoot. Jordan underwent neck surgery Tuesday morning to repair an injury to the disc in his neck. This is according to Dr. Joseph Maroon on WWE.com, the Lex Luthor to Daniel Bryan Superman. They performed a minimally invasive operation to decompress the nerve to allow it to heal. It's called a minimally invasive posterior cervical microdiscectomy. That's a mouthful. There's no timetable for how long until Jordan is going to come back. And I'm not familiar with this type of procedure, so it's hard to say if it's a matter of weeks. It's hard to say if it's a matter of months. It could be, you know, 2 months. Doesn't have to be like 6 months. It could be 2 months, 3 months, even 2 months. That would put him out of WrestleMania, most likely. But it was a minimally invasive procedure. So I hear that. I think a matter of weeks. They're probably going to cut it close. Probably 50-50 if Jordan will be there or not. And that leaves Seth Rollins, for now, without an obvious opponent going into WrestleMania, because it looked like we were headed for a match with him and Jordan. You know, if this was a few months ago, I would have said Kurt Angle and Jason Jordan, if not Kurt Angle and Triple H. But the issue really has been set up between Rollins and Jordan. And if Jordan's out of the picture, not only does Rollins lose a partner, you know, he loses a potential opponent for WrestleMania. Now, they could always start something with Rollins and Kurt Angle where he blames Kurt for sticking him with his son. And, you know, because it is looking a lot less likely that we're going to see something between Kurt Angle and Triple H, even though they sort of hinted at that on TV a few months ago after the Survivor Series. They've done nothing with them since. And there's been no, unlike on SmackDown with what they're doing with Daniel Bryan and Shane, there's been no indication that Stephanie is at all upset with Kurt Angle. Remember how she came on TV? Of course, she browbeat Kurt, you know, just completely, you know, ridiculed him and yelled at him. And we really haven't gotten a continuation of that, thank God. I guess Stephanie's a little preoccupied right now with her whole deal with Ronda that's coming up. But, you know, they could always start something with Rollins and Kurt Angle. And that's a match that, you know, like 5 or 10 years ago, I think would have been, not to say that Angle wasn't banged up even 5 or 10 years ago, but I think it would have been a much better match back then than it would be today. You know, but I can't see them not wanting Kurt to wrestle on that show. He wrestled on two shows so far, and neither of which was WrestleMania. This would be his first WrestleMania match in over a decade, and so he would be an attraction in a way on the card. I don't know how much of a drawing card he would be at this point as far as his match goes, but I can't see them not wanting him to wrestle on the show. I can't imagine him not wanting to wrestle on that show. I can't say I'm as excited as, you know, about that prospect after his last two matches that I saw him in, but, And you got to keep in mind, he also didn't have a whole lot of time to prepare for those matches, especially the one at TLC. I think he literally had 2 days' notice. They gave this guy 2 days' notice. And all in all, he didn't do a terrible job, but he didn't look great. Now, if he's had time to actually train, if he's been in training, figuring he might wrestle at Mania, and he's been getting ready, that might be a completely different story, right? I mean, he may be in a better state now. I don't know. I would just say if he is going to wrestle Seth Rollins, hopefully he has a chat with Sting first so he knows how to avoid the buckle bomb. We don't need to see that. By the way, Finn Balor is going to be teaming with Rollins on some of the upcoming live events. Might I suggest wrapping Balor in bubble wrap these next few weeks? Seth's partners haven't had too much luck on the injury front recently. I'm surprised Roman Reigns made it out of their match last Monday without turning an ankle or something. And I mentioned Cena, Strowman, and Elias to determine who enters the men's chamber last from the last pod. Strowman gave Cena the running power slam. He tried one on Elias. Elias slipped out, shoved him out of the ring, and stole the pin on John Cena. So Elias will enter last in the chamber. I cannot wait for Elias unplugged in the pod at the Elimination Chamber. Strowman was not happy about this. He ended up laying out Elias anyway. He picked up Cena, laid him out. And the funniest thing about all this, and Strowman was the one, he was the last man standing here. The thing I noticed about this was John Cena loudly calling spots. Surprise, surprise, I know, but Cena loudly calling spots to Braun Strowman. This was after the match, after he had just given Cena the power slam. And he looks up, he's like, slow it down, take your time. This after Brock Lesnar punched him in the head at the Rumble and told Braun to slow the fuck down. So apparently Braun Strowman is this super fast dude who just goes a million miles an hour, and everybody just wants him to slow the fuck down. I think Braun Strowman is doing just fine. So hopefully he keeps doing what he's doing. SmackDown Live from Kansas City on Tuesday. The graphics, the silly graphics are still there, but they toned them down at least a little bit this week. I think this will end up being like tout, right? You give them a few weeks to play with their new toy, get it out of their system. Eventually they'll move on. So no hint of a double turn in the Bobby Roode Rusev match for the United States Championship. I thought it was a good match. Roode won with the glorious DDT as he was doing his glorious pose when the match was over. Randy Orton came from out of nowhere and dropped him with an RKO. And he then laid out Aiden English and Rusev as well with a pair of RKOs. So Orton appears next in line against Roode. He looks to be the next challenger anyway. And I got to be honest with you, and I like Bobby Roode. Not so much as a babyface, but you know, I like Bobby. But the idea of a Randy Orton, Bobby Roode program honestly sounds like the most boring matchup of all time. Two men miscast as babyfaces, going one-on-one. The main event was Kevin Owens against Sami Zayn, with the winner challenging AJ Styles for the WWE title at Fastlane. WWE Fastlane. I gotta get it right. AJ Styles was at ringside doing commentary. I was very disappointed nobody asked Flat Earther AJ about the Falcon rocket that Elon Musk just launched into space the other day. I kid AJ. I know. AJ says he's not a flat earther. He blames Daniel Bryan for spreading those vicious lies. But he did say, now if you remember that segment from Talking Smack, okay, which is where this all goes back to, and I do miss Talking Smack, but AJ said something about Bryan that Bryan didn't take very kindly to, him not being very bright or something like that. And Bryan retaliated. Clearly, they had been talking about this probably earlier that day backstage, and Bryan remembered it, and he felt he had to stab back. He had to get back at AJ, and so he said, why don't we talk about the fact that AJ believes the earth is flat? And AJ said, I don't believe the earth is flat, but I've heard some stuff about it. Bryan was such a dick, he just wouldn't let it go. And AJ said, oh no, I'm not a flat, I didn't say I was a flat earther. I've just heard some stuff. So anyway, that's one of my favorite things from last year. I am not a flat earther, but I've heard some stuff. You can attribute that quote to AJ Styles. It is amazing, you gotta say though, it is amazing to think that right now as we speak, there is a Tesla Roadster flying through space with a mannequin in a spacesuit sitting in the driver's seat blasting David Bowie on the radio. And that is still only the second craziest thing I watched on YouTube all week. I also watched a video of a grandpa on America's Got Talent who sang Let the Bodies Hit the Floor. Apparently this clip was from like 2 years ago. I never saw it until now. If you've never seen it before, go watch this. This is unbelievable. It's just it's one of those things where this guy is like 82 years old and, you know, he's talking about his background and everything. And I used to be an engineer and blah, blah, blah. And now I do karaoke. And they're like, oh, okay, well, why don't you go ahead and do your thing? And you're expecting him to start singing anything but this. And they start, you know, playing the song and he just goes right into it. He goes right into that Drowning Pool song. And everybody is just, the looks on people's faces, it is the funniest thing that I've seen in a long, long time. And not for nothing, he didn't do a terrible job with it either. So if you want to see the most amazing thing you'll see all week, go on YouTube and find that clip. Owens and Zayn, meanwhile, these two could wrestle each other in their sleep. Not surprisingly, the match was good. It's been a while since I've seen Sammy bust out that diving tornado DDT spot through the turnbuckles. We got that here in this match. Sammy got up in AJ's face at the announce desk. AJ shoved him, and then AJ just started attacking both of them. He punched Sammy, he punched Owens. Referee called for the DQ. Daniel Bryan comes out. He announces that due to AJ's interference, both Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn would be getting a WWE title shot at Fastlane. In a triple threat match, which if you remember, is exactly what I said this thing was, exactly where I said this thing was probably headed. I said that last week. And so as predictable as this show is, that's exactly what they announced. Now, since then, there's been some developments. First of all, they announced on the show already, okay, before the main event even started, they put a graphic up and they announced that this Tuesday, Baron Corbin will go one-on-one against the returning Dolph Ziggler. The same Dolph Ziggler who walked out on the SmackDown brand 7 weeks ago, only to return at the Royal Rumble in the Royal Rumble match for all of 90 seconds. He's back. But wait, it gets better. So Shane McMahon goes on Twitter on Thursday to announce that the winner of that Baron Corbin-Dolph Ziggler match will be added to the WWE Championship match at Fastlane, making it a fatal four-way. So Shane is giving a WWE Championship opportunity to the same man who, after winning their United States Championship, surrendered the title and walked out on them. Boy, am I glad that in times like this, we have a top 10 list now to determine who does it... Oh, wait. Silly goose. I always fall for it. Silly goose I am. We did have our first top 10 rankings on this show, but conspicuous by their absence were the names Dolph Ziggler and Baron Corbin. They were nowhere to be found on said list. Shane McMahon is doing about as well with this commissioner thing as he did with that on-demand company that he was running when he was trying to break into China. The only reason for them to be doing this, and how I figure this all goes down, is for Ziggler and Corbin to go to some kind of a screwy finish on Tuesday. It then becomes a fatal five-way. Both of them get added to the match at Fastlane for the championship. That seems to be the end goal here. All the advertising for this show going back months had the main event as a five-way. Only then it was Orton and Nakamura who were also in the match. Now, Orton looks like he's going to be wrestling Bobby Roode, and Nakamura being in this match would make absolutely no sense. So, it's probably Ziggler and Corbin, with Ziggler being the one to eat the fall. But here's their top 10 list. I mentioned the top 10, right? The big SmackDown top 10. Here's their list after week one. They had Ty Dillinger at number 10. You talk about a played-out joke at this point. 2 years in a row, he's number 10 in the Royal Rumble match. Now he's number 10 in the top 10. If this guy ever gets a fancy WrestleMania entrance, they should dress him up as Moses and have him descend from the top of the set holding two stone tablets, recreate the Ten Commandments. Number 9 was Randy Orton. Number 8 was Becky Lynch. So they're mixing men and women, singles and tag teams here. Number 7 is the Usos. Number 6 is the New Day. Number 5 was Bobby Roode. Number 4 was Naomi. Yes, number 4 was Naomi. Number 3 was Shinsuke Nakamura. Number 2 was Charlotte, who was the reigning SmackDown Women's Champion. And number 1 was the WWE Champion, AJ Styles. Well, hey, at least the top 2 made sense. Naomi must be really well-liked by that locker room for all of them to vote her number 4. She was sandwiched in between Nakamura and the U.S. Champion. They're all baby faces, by the way, which I guess isn't surprising. I mean, this is just a popularity contest. I mean, if someone's a dick, why would you vote for them? But look, it's a storyline device. We'll see if any of this actually plays into a storyline. I'd like to think it will at some point, that this will all become clear why this is happening, why this at the moment makes no sense, which it doesn't. Maybe it's a way to get Randy Orton to go heel again, because he was ranked so low, who knows? I'm not sure why he would even care. Why would anybody care about this list? But the Ziggler and Corbin thing is exactly why I wish they did make that ranking stuff more legitimate. I know Shane and Brian are going, you know, tit for tat with each other, but they're trying to one-up each other on TV every single week. Or Shane is trying to one-up Brian anyway. But all it does is highlight that Shane McMahon is just really bad at his job. That's the only thing I really get out of this right now. Shane McMahon is a terrible commissioner. 205 Live. I wanted to mention that here. I did watch 205 Live, second week in a row. I'm not saying I'm going to make a habit out of this, but I've enjoyed what I've seen each of the last 2 weeks. And the main event on this week's show, which was Hideo Itami against Roderick Strong, was awesome and depressing all at the same time. As a match, I thought it was excellent. I really did. I enjoyed it as a match. A lot of hard-hitting stuff. I mean, look, you got two guys who you knew going in, these guys were going to stiff the crap out of each other. And they're both great wrestlers, and so you end up with a great match. That's not really all that surprising. What was depressing about it was the lack of crowd response, because these guys really were having a good match. Some of you might say, no, you're wrong. The definition of a good match, if the crowd isn't responding, it isn't good. You have some people who would make that argument. I disagree. But they weren't reacting at all. They were sitting on their hands for 95% of that match. And it just drives home the point that no matter what changes are made to this show, no matter how good the matches may be, when you have a crowd that does not care, it takes you out of the match. It really does. It takes you out of what you're trying to enjoy. They have to get this show into Full Sail. It's the only way to go. I mean, I see some people saying, you got to tape it before SmackDown. I guess you could do that too. I'll be honest with you though. Even if it's before SmackDown, I'm not even convinced at this point that these matches are going to get these great responses that everybody thinks they are. It's definitely worth trying. Absolutely, it's absolutely worth trying. But me, I would get this show into Full Sail. Pronto. Because you watch these two guys out there killing each other, having a good match, and nobody seems to care. And it's just really sad. I felt bad for those two guys out there. Now, on the big news front, where 205 Live is concerned, and I'm sure a lot of you have already seen the news by now, which involved Triple H. Triple H is supposedly the new showrunner for 205 Live. I could tell you that he is just by watching the show the last 2 weeks. It's very different from the segments that I had seen previously on 205 Live, which, you know, obviously with Enzo on the show, they were very character-driven, and Enzo was really he was the focal point of that show. You know, until all that stuff went down and Enzo disappeared. So Triple H has a little bit of a different idea. Vince McMahon wanted the show to be more character and gimmick driven. Triple H wants to make the show very similar to the presentation of the Cruiserweight Classic, which many of us who enjoyed the Cruiserweight Classic would have told you from day one that should have been the way they handled this division in the first place. The presentation of that tournament was outstanding. Everything about that tournament was outstanding. The matches were outstanding. The personality profiles, the story they tried to tell for some of these guys, the Brian Kendrick story, tying it into Daniel Bryan, who was one of the announcers for the show, and good friends going back all these years, and Bryan trying to be objective, but he can't really be objective, and he was all emotional when Bryan got bounced from the tournament, to the announcing itself with Mauro Ranallo and Daniel Bryan. Everything about the presentation of that tournament was outstanding. And you knew that taking it out of Full Sail and putting it in front of a more mainstream audience, whatever you want to call it, you knew it wasn't going to be the same, but you could have at least treated the show the same and sort of followed that same blueprint, and they didn't do that. They got away from it. From day one, they got away from that. and it was never the same. Now, I will say this much for Vince McMahon's vision of what he thought 205 Live should be. I look at a guy like Drew Gulak. Now, I saw Drew Gulak on a lot of independent shows a few years ago, not even that long ago. Here in Brooklyn, he'd be on shows here and there. He always had a distinctive look because as basic as he sort of looked, there was nothing flashy about him. But he would come out, no knee pads. I don't even think he had elbow pads. He would just come out and he was aggressive. You know, he would hurt people. He would beat them up. He was a wrestler. That was his gimmick. He didn't have a gimmick. He was a wrestler. And I look at Drew Gulak now, and a lot of the praise I see you guys giving him about the PowerPoint presentations and all that, and him holding up picket signs, and he is a lot more entertaining now than he was a year ago, 2 years ago. He was kind of boring. He was, you know, had no personality. They brought that personality out of him. I look at him now, just looking at him, and he looks like a completely different person. So he is a lot more entertaining. He is an example of someone who I think has greatly benefited from the Vince McMahon vision that he had for 205 Live. I can't say that for hardly anybody else on that show. But Drew Gulak is the one guy who really stands out to me as being the greatest beneficiary of Vince McMahon's mindset about what 205 Live should be. And it seems like they might actually be getting away from that now, because on the show you have that segment with, you know, Rockstar Spud, Drake Maverick, whatever, backstage with Tony Nese and Drew Gulak, telling them that you guys, what happened to you guys? You guys were great wrestlers, you were taken seriously, and now you're a joke. And just sort of teasing that those guys are going to sort of go back to their roots and they're going to maybe abandon some of the more comedic stuff. I think that's a mistake for someone like Gulak. I'd like to see them abandon that with most of the other guys and just let them sort of do their own thing and be themselves. With Gulak, I will say, I think that would be a mistake. I don't think the guy should be 100% goofball, but, you know, he needs to keep some of those elements to his character, because he really, I mean, he was about as exciting as watching paint dry before, and he really did benefit, I think, from that change. Overall, though, the division suffered. And the fact that Vince McMahon is stepping away, that he has stepped away and handed the reins over to Triple H, perhaps a sign of things to come. It's too early to say, you know, what's going to happen with 205 Live. Is 205 Live, you know, can it even be salvaged? Will it ever be a show that has high viewership and a lot of buzz around it? Can Triple H with 205 Live almost create with that show what he has created with NXT? Will 205 Live truly be its own brand one day? I don't think so. But I do think the shows the last 2 weeks, you watch those two shows, there is a distinct difference in the feel and the look, just overall of that show. It was obvious that some kind of a change was made. A head writer changed. I mean, I didn't know what the change was. When I saw this, I said, now it all makes sense. It was very, very noticeable. And now we're going to see. This is the Triple H mentality of how he thinks things should be. We're going to start to see whether or not Triple H is this great savior that people think he's going to end up being. That remains to be seen. What he's done with NXT is not necessarily what he would do with the main roster. He's done a tremendous job overseeing NXT. And I can't even just give him all the credit for it, because he's had talented people writing for him, working for him. But overall, you know, it's his vision. So this is going to be a very interesting experiment, because this truly is the first time that Vince has taken power that he had and has handed it off to his son-in-law. So I am watching this because I think that it could potentially be a sign of things to come. It's going to give us a lot of insight, I think, into how Triple H handles things, different elements of the show that maybe he incorporates into the show. Are guys treated as a joke? Are they treated more seriously? Is it more of a sports-like presentation like the Cruiserweight Classic was? Is it more storyline-driven? I don't get the sense that it is. It's more wrestling-heavy the last 2 weeks. You do need to have some compelling stories. The Cruiserweight Classic did. I just talked about that. The Brian Kendricks. There were one or two stories in that tournament that were very compelling. You could tell a story and still have a wrestling-centric show. And I think that's what Triple H is going for. Very, very interested, let's say, a month from now, 3 or 4 weeks from now, to see how this plays out. Right now, it has to be wrestling heavy because you have this Cruiserweight tournament that's ongoing and it's building all the way to WrestleMania. So that should be the most important thing to everybody on that show. Qualifying, advancing, wanting to go to WrestleMania, wanting to go to the kickoff show. I keep joking about that, but you know that's exactly where it's going to be. Going to the kickoff show to become the new Cruiserweight champion, that should be everybody's goal and focus on that show. The Mixed Match Challenge Week 4 saw Goldust and Mandy Rose, Rose Gold, against Jimmy Uso and Naomi Uso. This continues to be the most fun 20 minutes of WWE programming all week. Very obvious. They just let them go out there and just be themselves. I don't know if they mic them up more or they're just more vocal, but the smack talk back and forth between Jimmy and Goldust in the ring I thought was really funny. Daniel Bryan was voted by the fans over Kurt Angle to be the guest referee for the match, so of course, the SmackDown team won. The fix was in from the start. Bryan had this ridiculous tiny ponytail on top of his head. Naomi hit Mandy with the rear view. Jimmy hit a Samoan splash on Goldust, pinned him. So, husband and wife pick up the win. Speaking of husband and wife, that brought out Rusev and Lana. They walked out. The first thing Rusev did was refer to Jimmy as... he referred to Jimmy as Jim Uso. I don't know why I found that so funny, but I did, and I laughed. He led the crowd in a chant of, Lana is the best, Lana is number one. Or maybe it's in reverse. I completely screwed that up. He did a much better job singing that song. I won't sing it. But it's a special song that he created just for his wife. They meet Bayley and Elias this Tuesday in another first round match. It was originally going to be Bayley and Samoa Joe before Joe got hurt. So Elias slid in there, took Joe's spot with Bayley, and took Joe's spot in the Elimination Chamber. He's making the most of it. I won't lie, though. Given how fun the show has been and how loose everybody is in this mixed match challenge stuff, I think watching Joe being forced to team with Bayley makes me sad that we missed out on so much comedic potential.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Back at center stage in Atlanta this week for NXT, Nigel McGuinness was back as well. He's recovered from the flu. Of all the matches for him to miss, he had to miss that Gargano-Almas match at TakeOver. He's got to feel pretty shitty about that. Although probably not as shitty as the flu made him feel. They're teasing a breakup between Riddick Moss and Tino Sabatelli, who have had maybe half a dozen matches on TV this past year. They took on Heavy Machinery. They were tagging in and out in a very aggressive way for some reason. So I can't even really point to any one specific thing that would have caused this. But I can remember the first time Tino tagged out, he did so in such a way where the look on Moss's face indicated that he was not very happy with his partner. All I know is that Sabatelli got pinned. And after the match was over, Moss just stared him down outside the ring and threw his hands up in the air and just walked out. And I think breaking these two up would be a bad idea for the both of them. They need more teams, but I also don't see them doing much on their own, these two guys, right now. So if they follow through on this and they do break them up, I think they're making a big mistake. Johnny Gargano was out for a promo. He talked about the great response that he's gotten despite his loss to Almas at TakeOver. Also talked about Tommaso Ciampa whacking him in the back with a crutch. He was about to lay down a challenge when Andrade Cien Almas and Zelina Vega walked out. She called Gargano a loser. Vega started shoving him. That brought out Candice LeRae, who shoved Vega down on her keister. And her and Almas then bailed up onto the stage. And she said, you know, look, we've beaten you 3 times already. What do we have to do to get rid of you? And Johnny said, give me one more shot. One more shot at the NXT Championship. And Vega said, fine, but if we beat you, you have to leave NXT. And so naturally, Johnny Gargano accepted. I love Johnny Gargano. I think he maybe is the best babyface right now in the entire company. In fact, he probably is. unequivocally the best babyface in the entire company. But for someone who is now 0-3 against this man, to agree to put your career on the line if you don't win, you're either the dumbest man in NXT or the smartest, if we are to assume that his plan is to head to the main roster. Which, in and of itself, probably makes you the dumbest man in NXT. But it does make things interesting. Now, I have not read the spoilers, but if we assume that they are doing this match on TV in the next couple of weeks, and Gargano is not winning the championship, how do they handle that if he then ends up wrestling Ciampa, which he will, in New Orleans? Right? I mean, they could have Tommaso Ciampa actually cost Gargano the match this time, which would give William Regal a reason maybe not to honor the stipulation, and instead give Gargano a match with Ciampa at TakeOver. They could do that. Maybe they give him a match with Ciampa to try to win his job back. That could be interesting as well. I don't know. If it were me, I would have set up Gargano and Candice in a mixed tag against Almas and Vega with the stipulation that if Gargano and Candice win, Johnny gets one more shot. Then they win, and then in the championship match, Ciampa interferes at the very last second, costs Johnny the match, which then sets up their match at TakeOver. And you just don't bother with the whole loser leaves NXT stipulation. And if they really do want to move Gargano to 205 Live, which is where I assume he would be headed. And you know what? If Triple H has truly taken the reins of 205 Live, and it's his baby now, like NXT is his baby, and obviously he's worked very closely for many months now with Johnny Gargano, we may begin to see, you know, a new trend, a new pattern where guys like Gargano are called up to the main roster. They are called up to NXT, or to 205 Live, rather. And maybe they actually are handled in such a way that they keep their momentum going. Because if it's Triple H running NXT and it's Triple H running 205 Live, he already knows these guys. It's just sort of moving the chess pieces around the board. Maybe that wouldn't be so bad. Maybe Gargano would be okay under Triple H's watch on 205 Live. And they can build that show around him. That's what I mean with the whole thing is sort of an experiment. We don't know yet until that Cruiserweight tournament is over. And we really, actually, if we come post-WrestleMania, that's going to be the most interesting time, I think, for 205 Live. Do they call any new names up? Do they move up a Gargano? Do they move up a Ricochet? Maybe Ricochet's time in NXT is limited. And he goes right to 205 Live under Triple H's watch. And they do good by him and he becomes a big star. I'm very interested to see how Triple H, you know, handles a lot of these guys. I would have to think he knows them better than anybody. You know, he usually does well by them in NXT. Why would it be any different under his watch on 205 Live? So if they do want to call up Gargano, then, you know, maybe that isn't such a bad thing. And they could have Ciampa beat him at TakeOver, and Ciampa sticks around and Gargano leaves. Again, just speculating. Don't know that to be the case. But in NXT, I trust. They usually don't let me down with these things, so I'm sure in the end, this whole stipulation, all this, if Gargano loses, of course. Maybe he wins the championship. I'm sure I would have heard that by now if he did. I'm sure in the end, though, this will all make sense. That's how I would have done it, though. But look, we're getting Gargano Almas 4 on TV in the next few weeks. That's a TV main event to look forward to. I can't complain about that. Bianca Belair got a quick 30-second win just to remind us that she's still around. Clearly, she's going to be one of the biggest stories of NXT before this year is over. Her against Ember Moon, even her against Shayna Baszler down the road should be really good. Main event was Eric Young, Alexander Wolfe, and Killian Dane of Sanity beating the Undisputed Era in a Tornado Tag Team match. Having seen these guys go at it in a War Games match already, this was very tame by comparison. It was still a fun brawl. This was a showcase in a lot of ways for Killian Dane. He hit a drop kick into a senton at one point on Cole and Fish. That was pretty cool. He finished off Bobby Fish with the Ulster Plantation, the One-Winged Angel, for the win. It seemed like they were setting up, as of a few weeks ago, several weeks ago, they were setting up something with Killian Dane and Lars Sullivan. And also Roderick Strong and Lars Sullivan. Because Roddy had also sort of thrown out the challenge to Sullivan. And then Sullivan disappeared. And he only first returned on the live events this past week. Apparently he's had knee problems, which would explain that giant brace on his leg. And also a pituitary gland issue, I think the same one that Andre the Giant and Big Show had. Big Show had his taken care of. Andre knew about it and for whatever reason opted not to. So now that he's back, we'll see if they do Sullivan against Dane or if they somehow get Roddy involved and maybe build to a three-way match. I know Roddy is in the Cruiserweight tournament now and he's challenging Pete Dunne for the UK title this Wednesday on NXT, so he's a bit tied up with other things. We're also going to get Ember Moon this Wednesday in a rematch with Shayna Baszler for the NXT Women's Championship, so those are two matches to look forward to. Sad tweet for this week belongs to Impact Wrestling. It's been a while since Impact has won this award. They posted a promo with EC3 to build to their main event because their television is still very much behind, so even though EC3 has moved on, their TV has not. He has since debuted for NXT. And in the promo, he talks about, is he here or is he there? There meaning WWE. So they use that line in the tweet that they posted. Is he here or is he there? And then they wrote, who can say for sure? I can. I can say for sure. He's most definitely there. But this wasn't as bad as last year when they dubbed new commentary over footage of Bobby Roode. Remember that? They were airing this old GFW amped footage that they had literally sitting in the can for like 2 or 3 years. Jeff Jarrett for years was trying to sell the show to some network and nobody picked it up. So they started doing, you know, airing footage of this Global Force Wrestling stuff from like years ago. And they actually aired a show and they had footage of Bobby Roode. And they dubbed over new commentary over the footage to make it seem like he had jumped from NXT. They acknowledged that he was in NXT, and they made it sound like he, quote, made the jump to Global Force Wrestling. He made the jump. I don't know why they insist on opening themselves up to ridicule like this. They just set themselves up for it every single time. So, of course, people went after him for it and were mocking them for it, and rightfully so. I will say this. Newsweek did a whole story on the latest Impact reboot under Scott D'Amore and Don Callis. They interviewed EC3 for the piece as well. And EC3 said that his leaving the company had nothing to do with the finances. It had everything to do with him just wanting to challenge himself and try something new. He said he had 6 months left on his contract. It was a very lucrative contract. It was very talent-friendly is how he referred to it. He said Anthem treated him with nothing but respect throughout the entire process, his whole time there. They also interviewed Ed Nordholm for the piece. And I give Ed a lot of credit. You know, people have shit on him before, and I've called him out before on the whole Hardy stuff, but I have to give him a lot of credit. He admitted here in this interview what a huge mistake it was to fight back the way he did with the Hardys over the whole Broken Universe stuff last year. He said his biggest mistake was attacking a Hispanic woman for protecting her man. Obviously referencing Rebbie Hardy. He said, as somebody who is new to the wrestling world, who came in from a corporate environment where they don't play well in the social media world, we clearly took on a shitstorm, and I got my head handed to me. And it was after that that they implemented the new change in Impact, where talent can now retain the rights to their names and their characters. They could take them elsewhere. He made a mistake, and he owned up to it. Good on him. Good on him for admitting that. PR-wise, that was an absolute disaster for them. It never should have happened in the first place. But the fact that he owns up to it now and admits that he made a mistake, I think is a good thing. It's a positive thing, and I think it reflects well on him, and I just wanted to mention that here and just give him some credit for that, because he didn't have to do that, and there's a lot of people in his position, you know, a lot of other promoters and CEOs and other wrestling companies and whatnot who I don't think would ever publicly admit to their mistakes like that. And he did. And I think he deserves credit for that. Let's get to your mailbag questions. We got a bunch of them here. A lot of classic questions, too. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We're going to start here with Alex from Brussels, Belgium. I have a question about Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant from the NBC special 30 years ago called The Main Event. What is your opinion about the match and what made it so special? Was there a reason why WWE took the belt off of Hulk Hogan. Yeah, I'm glad that you asked about this. And actually, Bruce Pritchard on his podcast, he just dedicated an entire show to that main event show from February of 88. And I haven't heard it yet, but it's in my queue. I want to check that out because that whole period and that whole show, like that was my deal as a kid, man. I mean, that was a big deal to me. And even now, I love going back and watching those shows. So I'm curious to hear what some of the other goings on were like behind the scenes there. But what I remember from this is, and as far as in my opinion of it and why Hogan dropped the belt, I mean, my understanding was that Hogan was going off to film scenes for No Holds Barred. No Holds Barred was the movie with Zeus. It came out the following year. He needed some time off. So they decided to take the belt off of him, and they had this whole plan. They had it all mapped out a year in advance, more than a year. They were going to put Hogan together with Savage and build up this whole Mega Powers thing. They were going to build Savage up to a point where he could become champion, which he did. And eventually Hogan was going to come back and Savage would turn and Hogan would take the belt from him. They had their whole story mapped out, and so that's why they did what they did. As far as the special itself, I think maybe three matches, I think it might have only been two, that actually aired. Obviously there were more matches that night that were taped. I think only two or three aired on TV. I remember the Savage Honky Tonk Man match for the Intercontinental Championship, and you know the fact that, I'm sure many of you have heard the story, that Savage was going to win the IC title. DiBiase, and this is certainly what Ted DiBiase was always, he was always under the impression that he was going to win the WWF title. DiBiase was going to win the championship in the tournament of WrestleMania 4. And Honky, when it came time, said, nah, I'm not going to drop the belt. And as he's told the story before, you know, he felt it would hurt his value if he was going to make the jump at some point and maybe go to the NWA And so he was not going to lose the championship on this show to Macho Man. And it sort of changed the trajectory of wrestling history, sort of, in a way, right? Who knows where things ultimately would have ended up for some of these guys if DiBiase got the belt and Savage didn't. I think Savage eventually would have. But maybe we don't get that great Mega Powers angle paying off the way that it did. I'm glad things worked out the way it did. I feel bad for DiBiase, but, you know, hey, shit happens, and he ended up having a pretty good career for himself. But I remember the Hogan-Andre match, and one of the things that I remember, and I hope that Pritchard talked about this on that podcast, I haven't listened yet, so I don't know, but it's something I always noticed, and it's one of the funniest little Easter eggs if you watch for it. So before the match, Hulk Hogan is in the back with, I guess it would have been Mean Gene, doing an interview, and he's got the Hogan, what I call the Hogan 87 belt. I think that's what it's pretty commonly referred to as. It was the design of his championship from 1987, right? So he's back there. He's wearing the Hogan 87 belt, cutting a promo. They cut back into the arena. This special aired live. Hogan comes out to make his entrance, and forget the fact that in the back he was, you know, glistening, and here he's not. Clearly these things were taped in advance. But he comes out wearing a completely different championship belt. This was the debut of the Winged Eagle. Right? Because the Winged Eagle had never appeared before this. And then at WrestleMania, the title was vacant. They had Robin Leach come out. The belt was in this velvet red display case. And it was almost like, it almost seemed like the debut of a new championship. It really wasn't. He debuted the Winged Eagle belt here on this show. No fanfare at all. No mention about it or anything. So in the back, he's wearing one belt. He comes out with a completely different belt. And I'm sure it was just one of those things they didn't think of. But it's a funny thing, if you really pay attention, how he just wears two different belts on the show. And nobody really seems to even notice and say anything about it. I guess if they screwed up, they wouldn't want to draw attention to it. But I sure remember that. I sure noticed. I know I'm not the only one. And it was a very big deal. Hogan losing on that show was a huge deal. He had been unbeaten. He had been champion for, what, 4 years? 4.5 years by that point? So him losing, and then the way in which he lost, that is still maybe the greatest angle that that company has ever done. I was a big fan of the Mega Powers angle, and so that's up in the conversation as well. So back to back, I mean, here in 88, and then the Mega Powers angle that immediately followed going into 89, was some of the best storytelling and two of the best angles that company has ever done in its entire existence. And the twin, you know, the evil twin referee angle with the Hebners was so great because nobody in WWE had seen Earl. Earl had been working for the NWA. He had become available, and Vince was made aware of it. He loved the idea when they, you know, came up, when he realized, oh, this guy has a twin brother. I didn't realize that Dave's brother was an identical twin. And they came up with this idea, and it just worked to perfection. So Hogan gets counted, right, down for the three, even though his shoulder is clearly up. They give the belt to Andre. One of the other funny moments was Andre in the post-match promo talking about how he just won the World Tag Team Championship. And now I surrender the World Tag Team Championship to Ted DiBiase. Andre was just out to lunch. I wouldn't be surprised if he was so pilled up or boozed up because he was probably in so much pain. He probably didn't even know where he was. So he called it the tag team title. But Hogan is obviously beside himself because he had his shoulder up. He just got screwed. 4 years as champion, and that's how his title reign comes to an end. And all of a sudden, we see Earl. And Earl is face-to-face with Dave. Remember the whole doink thing at WrestleMania 9? You have one doink, two doinks. They're looking at each other. They're mirroring each other's actions. Well, here you have Earl and Dave, and Hogan's looking at them like, what the hell's going on here? And trying to figure out who's the real Dave Hebner. Earl beats up Dave, kicks him. Apparently, he really injured his brother. He caved in his ribs, kicked him in the rib cage. Hogan knows now, okay, I know who the evil one is. I talked about this recently. He chucked him into the aisleway. They were supposed to catch Earl. Hogan threw him with such force that he overshot Andre and DiBiase and Virgil, and he just almost got killed. Earl Hebner did. And then Hogan backstage cried like a bitch when it was over. He was literally in tears back when winning and losing championships actually felt like it meant something. Although I have to say Hogan did go too far here with this, but he was just in tears and, you know, he was talking. Now, he wasn't talking about, you know, he had an evil twin. He made it seem like DiBiase paid someone, some random person, to undergo plastic surgery to look exactly like Dave Hebner. So it wasn't that it's Dave's brother. Like, it really wasn't even supposed to be an evil twin the way Hogan was talking about it here. DiBiase paid off somebody to go have plastic surgery. And then he's like, look at the $100 bills falling out of the referee's pocket. He was paid off. How much for the plastic surgery? I mean, it's a great promo because it's so awful that it's just, you can't not watch that and just laugh and be entertained by it. So I remember a lot about that show, about that match. It was just great stuff. I mean, the whole twin referee thing, it was such a genius idea. And I don't know if that was Vince, if that was Bruce, if it was just a collaboration where they just said, hey, wait a minute, evil twin. I don't know exactly the person who came up with it, but they should get a raise. If it's Vince, he should have given himself a raise. It was a great, great angle. The match itself, you know, from a match perspective, was terrible. I mean, Andre was barely mobile at that point. Even the finish, I mean, he was supposed to, I don't know if he was supposed to give him a hip toss or what it was, but Andre just sort of flung him and then fell down on top of him. It was rough. Watching Andre matches back then was very rough. But the angle itself is one of the greatest they've ever done. David from Sacramento, with the popularity of the Velveteen Dream and your wish of NXT having a mid-card title, how would you feel if Dream went after the UK championship? Lately, guys like Gargano and Strong have been challenging Pete Dunne. I think it would be creative if the Velveteen Dream considered this part of his Velveteen tour. Have him win the title in controversial fashion, maybe a double pin. He then returns to Full Sail with a new Dream Championship to face Pete Dunne at TakeOver in a title-for-title match. Oh, the facial expressions from Pete Dunne if he ever had to have a match with the Velveteen Dream. For that reason alone, I hope those two have a match at some point. I don't know if I would do the idea exactly in that way. I mean, I'm fine having Dream challenge for the UK title at some point. And I don't really care how they get to it. I think somebody like Velveteen Dream was tailor-made to be, to hold a secondary title in NXT. You know, right now, Almas is the champion. I think Aleister Black will end up having a run with the championship. So what do you do with Velveteen Dream? He doesn't need a title. But I have felt for a long time now that NXT really could benefit at this point from a secondary belt. And actually, it's funny you call it the Dream title because he's the Velveteen Dream. My idea when I first pitched it to have a secondary belt was after Dusty Rhodes had passed away. And my suggestion was, that you call it the Dream Championship as a tribute to Dusty. Now, they ended up just doing the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic instead, which they're bringing back and should be fun. And I'm looking forward to it. But that was originally the name I gave it. I was call it the Dream Title. So, yeah, hey, if they want to have Velveteen Dream now bring in a new belt and call it the Dream Belt, fine with me. I don't care how you do it, but NXT, with all the talent now that they have, I feel like down there, they need a secondary title for the singles division. They have tag team belts and a women's belt, and that's fine. For everybody else, though, they need their own version of what would be an IC title, basically. Chris from Ajax, Ontario, Canada, what would you think of an NXT Royal Rumble? Same stipulation as the main roster, last man standing wins a championship match at the TakeOver show before WrestleMania. I don't know, three Rumble matches in one weekend is just too many. You got the Women's Rumble and the Men's Rumble in that one night, and then the night before you would have a third Rumble. I don't know. I feel like that's too many. I'll say this though, if they do, maybe follow Aztec Warfare rules. Lucha Underground took those Royal Rumble rules and they changed them a little bit. And they do Royal Rumble matches now better than WWE does. The way that those matches work, you have 90-second intervals. So it's like a Rumble where everybody comes out and gets an entrance. But there's no over-the-top rope elimination, so the whole floor is lava concept goes out the window. And instead, it's pinfalls and submissions only. No DQs, no countouts. You can do dives and flips over the top rope and not risk, eliminating yourself. It's pin or submission in the ring only. And again, no DQ, so anything goes. Want to bring weapons in, bring weapons. I guess you could do that now in the Royal Rumble. They just generally don't. But I think the Aztec Warfare spin could be an interesting way to tweak things so it's not exactly like the Royal Rumble, but it's sort of their own version of the Royal Rumble. I mean, they probably should come up with a new name for it. I wouldn't call it a Royal Rumble match. You can call it an NXT Rumble. Take the word Royal out, or just come up with a completely different name for it. Then I think it might be okay, but I still think you're running a risk. Three Rumbles in one weekend, I think, is probably too many. Hank from Mount Vernon, Ohio. I have a question about CM Punk. I watched wrestling as a kid in the late 80s, early 90s. I came back for the Attitude Era, stopped watching again around 05. My most recent return came in the fall of 2014 after Punk had already left. I became aware of him through his podcast with Colt Cabana, researched him a little bit, and found the Pipe Bomb segment. I watched his WWE documentary, and I've also watched his matches that you praised on your show with Undertaker at WrestleMania, John Cena at Money in the Bank, and Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. Can you recommend any other really important matches or feuds that you think someone who wants to know about CM Punk and his WWE time should watch? Well, his best WWE feud was with John Cena. The Cena-Punk stuff was as good as any feud that John Cena has had in his entire career. His greatest rival, I would say, is CM Punk. More than Randy Orton, more than Edge, more than The Rock. I mean, him and The Rock, Cena and Rock may have made more money. So if you judge it strictly based on that, you could say Rock was Cena's greatest rival. But really, it was CM Punk. I would say Punk and AJ Styles really are the two guys who consistently gave John Cena the best matches of his career. Punk's feud with Daniel Bryan also had some great matches. There's one in particular from, what was that show? Over the Limit, I think it was called. So this would have been back in 2012. That was a great match. So I enjoyed their feud for the matches. I wouldn't call that an important feud, though. When I think of feuds that really put Punk on the map as a heel, and two that really don't get talked about as much as those other ones, are his feud with Jeff Hardy in 2009, and his feud with Rey Mysterio in 2010. Those programs paved the way for the Pipe Bomb in 2011, and him being taken seriously as a top guy in that company. So, with Hardy, Jeff was on his way out of the company. He was going to leave. He was completely burned out. He was hurting. I guess it was a contract expiration, and he didn't want to sign. He was burned out. He needed time away. And he even committed to sticking around an extra few months. He didn't have to do that. He did it for the company. The company asked him. He agreed. and he stuck around some extra months so that he could put Punk over hard on his way out. He did things the right way. And the two of them were polar opposite. So Punk was the straight edge guy, and he would mock Jeff and his drug problems. And Jeff was just a very eccentric guy anyway. He's into a lot of different things. He does artwork. He does, what was it, motocross or whatever the hell it is, dirt bikes. Anyway, it led to this great TLC match that they had at SummerSlam back in 09. That's another match I would recommend. Right after Hardy left is when he got popped at home for pills, and he got into some legal trouble. And he had a lot of heat with CM Punk after that. And they may still have heat. I don't know. Remember that video that the Hardys put online? They were in a diner one night, and they were cutting shoot promos on CM Punk. They weren't in a... Let's just say they were in no condition to perform while they were filming this video. So there was a lot of heat there because WWE had Punk go on TV. This was right after Jeff left, and then the news came out that he got, you know, arrested and all that. Was he arrested? I guess he was arrested. But he got in a lot of legal problems. And so WWE had Punk go on TV and mock him. He went on TV, and he was cutting a promo one night. Might have been the September pay-per-view. And he's mocking Jeff Hardy and his problems for heel heat. Jeff probably figured, watching that, I'm sure he was like, what the hell? Like, I stuck around longer than I had to help put this guy over. I made this guy a made man, and that's how you repay me? By mocking my problems on TV after I'm gone? Vince McMahon sure does have a funny way of showing his appreciation for his talent. I will say that much. Just ask Punk. I owe you one, pal. Right? You just have to ask CM Punk. The Mysterio feud was pretty important, too, I thought, as far as establishing Punk as like a really creepy heel. He was doing this cult leader gimmick at the time. He had his own faction called the Straight Edge Society. I still remember the segment on SmackDown where Rey had his family in the ring. It was Rey Mysterio's daughter's birthday. And his daughter was maybe like 9 or 10 years old at the time. And Punk's out there with the rest of his group. And he's in the ring and he like kneels down. He's talking to Rey's daughter. And he starts singing happy birthday to her in like the creepiest way possible. Like you can't forget a segment like that. That was a memorable segment. And the two of them had some great matches that year. I mean, I don't remember their WrestleMania 26 match being much, but they wrestled, I think, at the next two pay-per-views after that. They had matches that were much better. So I would say don't sleep on those two feuds. Don't sleep on the Hardy or the Mysterio feud. Gavin from Salt Lake City. You mentioned a few weeks ago about how you love the 1992 Royal Rumble match, but you think the rest of the show sucked. While I am not disagreeing, I thought Roddy Piper's IC title win was a great moment. Well, let me stop you there. I do too. I've never said otherwise. I said as far as the matches themselves go, they were mostly bad. But Piper winning the championship on that show was a highlight. Absolutely. So Gavin and I are in agreement on that. He says, the road to get there is still confusing for me to this day. For over a month, they promoted Bret Hart versus the Mountie for the Intercontinental title, only for Bret to drop it to Mountie at a house show because he had the flu. Then Piper gets the belt, leaving Mountie with one of the shortest reigns of all time. To this day, I cannot find a consensus as to why this all took place. What is the real story behind the change? Okay, here's the story. There were other stories at the time that Bret Hart was negotiating to jump to WCW with the IC title. He was going to take the belt with him. He was, you know, got an offer. He was going to go to WCW. He was going to make the jump. Ric Flair just jumped to WWE only a few months before, and he brought the big gold belt with him. Now, he owned the belt because he had put down a deposit and wasn't paid back that deposit, so it was his property. He was within his rights to take that belt with him. But that was a big, you know, thing at the time, that he had taken the belt that was most closely associated with you know, the NWA, the big gold belt, and now he pops up on the rival's television show with their championship. So that was a big story, and it led to a big lawsuit, and it was a big deal. And it was a huge black eye to WCW when that happened, and I guess their idea was to do something similar to embarrass WWE. Whatever talks Bret may have had with WCW in early 92, and obviously he ended up not going, he gave it some serious thought. He didn't realize that his contract with Vince had rolled over. And he could not have left the company even if he wanted to. He was trapped there for at least another year. Didn't even realize it. Whatever talks there may have been with WCW had nothing to do with him dropping the IC title. Brett claims that the month before, so this would have been December of 91, they're at a show. Roddy Piper pulls him aside one night, tells him what the plan was. The plan was for Brett to drop the belt to the Mountie. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to pretend that you're sick, you have the flu, you're not feeling well, you have a fever, you lose the belt to Mountie, so that I, Piper, can win the championship from Mountie, and then the plan was that Brett would beat Piper to win the belt back at WrestleMania. That was always the plan. Even before all the talk about Brett, you know, having secret negotiations with WCW, that was the plan. Piper gave him a heads up. He said, look, Vince is going to come to you. He's going to talk to you about this. I just want you to know that this is the plan. And Vince did eventually go to Brett. Brett pretended like this was the first time he was hearing this. And he was all excited about the idea, and Vince was very relieved because he didn't know how Brett was going to react. And so that's how that all worked out. And Vince also told him when they had their conversation, okay, you're going to win the belt from Piper at WrestleMania. We also want you to drop the title to Shawn, that being Shawn Michaels, in the fall. So that's how far in advance they were thinking about things here. And Brett said that he was fine with that. At least that's what he says. He says that I was okay with that idea. I had a lot of respect for Shawn Michaels, and so I had no problem with that. The idea that towards the end of the year, I would do the honors for Shawn, and I will drop the IC title to him. And that would jive with what I was talking about last week when I answered that question about SummerSlam 92. And the idea that Brett against Shawn in a ladder match for the championship was going to be the plan for the IC title, that is. That was going to be the plan for SummerSlam had they gone to Washington, D.C. instead of Wembley Stadium. Now, obviously, they did it at Wembley instead. Shawn ended up beating Bulldog for the belt a few months later after that. So Vince's plan was, it never changed. We want to get the IC belt on Shawn in the fall. It didn't exactly work out the way they had originally planned, but Shawn did get the Intercontinental Championship in the fall. So it all worked out in the end. Maybe not for Bulldog. Didn't work out too well for him. But that's his own fault. So it really was just done to get the belt on Roddy Piper, to give Bret Hart a big win and just give him some credibility at WrestleMania by beating somebody who was rarely beaten. Look, Piper never did pinfall jobs back in the day. Even Hogan, when the two of them in 85, the war to settle the score, and I mean, the first WrestleMania was a tag team match, but when Piper would go one-on-one with Hogan, even then, Piper never did a clean job to Hulk Hogan. He might have lost to him. There might have been a count out in there or something, but he didn't do a job to the big leg, I'll tell you that much. So Piper doing a job to Brett was a very big deal. And it did give Brett a lot of credibility. That was the biggest win of Bret Hart's career up to that point. Before he beat Flair later that year, the win over Piper was the biggest win, the biggest victory of his entire career. Francois from Quebec sent in this audio question.
Hey, Saw Monster, this is Francois from Quebec. In your opinion, what are the top five best WWF In Your House shows? If you had to recommend five In Your House shows, what would they be?
Okay, five of the best In Your House pay-per-view. And you guys chime in too, because I want to know your thoughts on this. So I was thinking about this, and I thought of a lot of In Your House shows that when I thought about them, I said, well, only the main event was really worth a damn. You know, there were a lot of really bad matches on some of those In Your House pay-per-views. But I narrowed it down to this. This would be, in no particular order, this is my list of five of the best, or the five best overall WWE In Your House pay-per-view shows. I put Mind Games from September of 1996 on the list. That main event was one of the best WWE matches of that entire decade. Shawn Michaels and Mankind for the championship. I can't say enough good things about that match. I can't say enough, and that includes the post-match too. Even though we got a DQ finish in that match, the stuff with Undertaker popping up out of the casket, everybody losing their minds. It was just so well done. And, you know, the best match of Foley's career. I mean, He has said that physically he was in the best shape of his life, the best shape of his career anyway, for that match, and it showed. And obviously it was very early in his WWE run. He was a lot less beat up than he would be even a couple of years later. So, you know, we had Mankind at you know, sort of Mankind's peak in a way, and Shawn Michaels was in the middle of his championship run, and they just had a chemistry that, you know, you can't replicate that. You can't manufacture that. You either have it or you don't. And I think there were probably a lot of people going in who didn't know what to expect. Shawn Michaels, the pretty boy, high flyer. Mankind, more of a brawler. Shawn hung in there with him. Goes both ways. You know, it was Mankind's greatest performance, and it was one of Shawn's as well. Also on that show was the famous promo with Steve Austin, Owen Hart, and Brian Pillman. So this wasn't even a match. A lot of the other matches that I'll be honest with you on that card, I don't remember as being all that great, but I'm putting this show on here for the main event and for this promo. This was the promo where Austin was calling out Bret Hart. He was calling out Bret Hart as much as he could to try to get Bret to come back and have a match with him. And in this promo, he called the Hitman. He said, if you put the letter S in front of the word Hitman, you have my exact thoughts about Bret Hart. And I think he called Bret at one point the slimy substance that comes out of the southern end of a chicken. But that one line about putting the letter S in front of Hitman, I never forgot that. That's one of the all-time great promo lines. And Austin had some great promos, especially in 96, right? A lot of memorable lines from Steve Austin that year. That one may be at the top of the list. So watch that promo and watch the main event, and you'll come away from this thinking it's the greatest pay-per-view they ever did. Revenge of the Taker was Revenge of the Taker was April of 1997. And the main events on that show were Bret Hart against Steve Austin. And you know the chemistry Bret Hart and Steve Austin had. I mean, they never really had a bad match. So you had them in the main event. And I'll tell you this much. That Austin-Bret Hart match was a much better match than what we originally were supposed to get, which was Bret Hart against Psycho Sid. Okay, that was announced already on TV. And then Sid left or got fired, whatever it was that happened with him. I think he may have been hurt, but he disappeared. And instead, we got an Austin-Bret rematch from WrestleMania, which wasn't as good as WrestleMania, but it was still a very good match. And the other main event on that show was for the WWF title. It was Undertaker defending against Mankind. There's that name again. Mankind took a header off the apron, famous bump, right through the announce table. I think at the end of that match was also where Undertaker set Paul Bearer's face on fire. He was using the paper mache. What do they call it? The flash paper. And he was supposed to light up a little fireball, and he threw it on Paul Bearer. And something went wrong, and he actually legitimately burned him. So that was very scary. But a great match. You know, you think about all the matches Undertaker and Mankind had, and everybody talks about the Hell in a Cell match at the King of the Ring in 98. I mean, that match was all about Foley basically throwing himself off the top of the cage and taking bumps here and bumps there. It's so hard to grade that match when you say to yourself, like, is that the greatest match? Is that the greatest Hell in a Cell match? Is that Mankind's greatest match? I don't even know how you grade that match. On what scale do you grade that? Like, everybody has their own definition of what they consider to be a great match. To this day, I put like a little star next to that match because I don't know how to rank it. I mean, it was a great spectacle. Was it a great match? I don't really know that it was. It was a hell of a spectacle, though. So how you rank that and grade that, I don't know. But they had other great matches. The Boiler Room Brawl at SummerSlam in 96 is another one. I enjoyed the Buried Alive match they had. I have a soft spot for that stipulation. I know it's stupid, but I always kind of liked the Buried Alive stip. And then you have this match here that doesn't get a lot of love, but it should because they had a really good match. So both main events, I think, make that show. Canadian Stampede, July 1997, I think is pretty widely regarded as one of the best overall pay-per-views WWE ever did. It's probably easily the best in-your-house show they ever did. Those shows back then were only 2 hours long. They didn't become 3 hours until later that year, so they didn't overstay their welcome. They had a short card, 4 or 5 matches. They got in, they got out. And the matches that night, there was a championship match with Undertaker and Vader that I remember being pretty damn good. And we had, actually it was Mankind and Triple H open the show. And I remember them having a good match as well. Taka Michinoku against the great, now I've heard different pronunciations. I've heard people say the great Sasuke. I've heard people say the great Sasuke. I still don't know. I don't know for sure what's the right pronunciation. Somebody will fill me in on exactly what is the correct pronunciation. I call him the great Sasuke. If I'm wrong, I apologize. All I know is the two of them had a great match on that show that was designed to get Sasuke over, and instead, it got Taka over. It was the exact opposite of what they originally intended. And hey, Taka got himself a contract out of it, so good for him. And then, of course, the main event was the 10-man tag, the Hart Foundation against Steve Austin, Ken Shamrock, Goldust, and LOD. Just, I can't say enough good things about that match. The crowd heat was off the charts. You go back and watch that match, in the opening like 3 or 4 minutes, there's a sequence where Brett has Steve Austin in the corner. They're slugging back and forth. Brett gets the upper hand. He's punching Steve and kicking Steve. They go back to the hard camera, and the camera is shaking. The building is literally shaking, and that was the opening minutes of that match. So if you have never seen that match before, drop what you're doing, go back, and watch back at a time when crowds actually had a pulse and they used to react to things. I know this is kind of a foreign concept sometimes these days, but believe it or not, the crowds themselves used to have a lot of emotion. I don't know where it's gone, but it definitely used to be there, and that match is a great example of it. St. Valentine's Day Massacre, I have that on my list as well, February 1999. Why do I have St. Valentine's Day Massacre on my list when there weren't a whole lot of great matches on that show? I think Austin McMahon in a cage is a big deal. That was the first time we really got a true singles match between Austin and Vince. They held off a long time. They added the cage step. That was the night Big Show debuted. He came up from under the ring. I thought the finish was really clever, by the way, where he throws Austin into the cage and the panel breaks and very slowly sort of swings open. And then Austin very calmly climbs, just climbs down and hits the floor. I thought it was a very clever way to do that finish while, you know, keeping Big Show looking strong. I mean, he's a giant of a guy who just debuted. You want him to look like a monster. But they had like a hardcore match earlier that night, I think it was Al Snow and Hardcore Holly, and they brawled out of the building into the Mississippi River. I used to love all that hardcore stuff when they would brawl out of the buildings and they would brawl backstage. I was a sucker for that. So I enjoyed that. Rock and Mankind had a championship match on that show. I just remember it was a good match, but the finish really pissed me off because it was a double chair shot simultaneously where they whacked each other. And the chair shots didn't look particularly brutal. They just happened to hit each other at the same time, and they knocked each other out. And they were both laid out unconscious, and the match ended on a no decision. I just thought it was such a goofy finish. It's just such a cop-out, so dumb. But that show was very significant for that Austin McMahon match, and I enjoyed it, you know, for what it was. And Vince is an absolute crazy bastard, taking that bump off the side of the cage the way he did. It's a miracle he survived that. So go back and watch that show for the main event, really, more than anything else. There's a couple of other, you know, decent matches on there. Backlash 1999. This was an easy one for me. This was a show that had, you know, another one of those hardcore matches. You had Bob Holly and you had Al Snow, and they brawled to the back. Like I said, I loved those garbage matches where they would just brawl all over the building and out of the building. So they had that. We had a boiler room brawl, only the second one ever, between Mankind and Big Show. That was actually pretty damn good. We had Ken Shamrock and The Undertaker. Now, it's been a while since I've seen that match. I don't remember the match standing out to me because it was a great match or anything, but it's kind of unique to think back that Undertaker had a match with Ken Shamrock. Because I don't know that we ever, I think it might have been the only time we ever saw that match. So it was kind of unique in that way. And then the main event was Austin and Rock. I still maintain that the Steve Austin Rock match at Backlash in 99 for the title was better than their WrestleMania 15 match. And this was the match where we had that funny spot where Rock is holding the camera, the TV camera. They're both standing on the announce table. And he pans over and there's Steve Austin. He flips him the bird with the camera, still holding the camera, Rock is. And he gets stunnered. I think Shane was the guest referee for that match. It was a great match. It was a great match, and I maintain better than their WrestleMania match. So those would be my five. Mind Games, Revenge of the Taker, Canadian Stampede, Valentine's Day Massacre, and Backlash 99. George writes in, I was browsing YouTube and came across the end of the Corporate Rumble from January of 99. At the end of the match, as China eliminates Vince McMahon, he takes a very, very nasty bump to the outside. His head gets caught between the bottom rope and the mat, bouncing between the two. With the double quad tear and even the recent Kevin Owens headbutt, is Vince McMahon the most dangerous to himself in the ring? Oh, I don't know. He gave his son a pretty good mouse under his eye in their match at WrestleMania 17. And Stone Cold has a permanent gash on the back of his head from a hard chair shot that Vince McMahon once gave him. So he's a danger to others too, not just himself. But that Corporate Rumble finish that you mentioned, the Corporate Rumble, that was just as nasty a bump as you'll ever see. Big Boss Man took a bump like that out of the Rumble match in 92, where he got his head caught under the bottom rope on the way down and it sort of whiplash. But what happened to Vince was way more violent. He looked like he was almost decapitated. Vince McMahon is probably one of the clumsiest guys that I've ever seen inside a wrestling ring. He could never take a stunner the right way. Every time I saw him take a Stone Cold Stunner, it looked terrible. There was the one time on Raw, he mistimed it, literally fell down before Austin could even hit the move. He did the same thing once with Triple H, taking a pedigree. That was during the segment where Triple H was renewing his wedding vows. Remember that with Stephanie? And he called her a no-good lying bitch and then went to pedigree her dad, and Vince jumped too soon and screwed the whole move up. You know what the funny thing is, though? I have to say this on the stunner stuff. Rarely, if ever, did I see him take a good stunner until Raw 25. A few weeks ago, like after all these years, the guy now is, what, 72 years old? He finally took a stunner that actually looked good. See, so now he can retire. I don't need to see him taking bumps anymore. James from Staten Island, I'd like to get your thoughts on Bray Wyatt and his lack of credibility as a performer. I've had a number of people tell me that the reason WWE won't push him and protect him is because of his weight and his previous marital issues. I personally don't feel Bray is to blame for the state of his character, and it's more attributed to the booking of his character. What or who in your mind is to blame for that? I don't think it has anything to do with his weight. I don't think it has anything to do with his marital infidelities or anything like that. This has been going on for a long time now. And even when Bray first came up and we had the Wyatt family intact and they had that great feud, the great match at Elimination Chamber with the Shield, this guy was off to the races. You got to remember, we're going back literally 4 years. That was 4 years ago. And then we went to New Orleans, where we're back this year, WrestleMania 30. He had that great like voodoo entrance at WrestleMania. Everything seemed to be clicking for this guy, and then he lost to John Cena. Now, in a vacuum, if he had just lost to Cena, but everything else stayed the same after that, and he just, you know, kind of kept on winning, and it wouldn't have been such a big deal, but it was sort of, I don't say the beginning of the end, but it was the beginning of a definite downturn for his character. And you can blame the booking to a point. You can't lay all of it on WWE. I do blame WWE for just not knowing what the hell to do with that Bray Wyatt character. I think they had in Bray a persona that could have been, and I hate to make these comparisons, I compare it to The Undertaker only because Undertaker was this sort of mythical, he was undead, but you know, he was this mythical character that was so ridiculous but was handled so well, and you know, just made out to be larger than life. He was given the special entrance. He had the special effects. He would lose a lot. Undertaker, no, we're talking wins and losses here. Undertaker lost a lot. You go back to the mid-90s, he had to work with a lot of stiffs. Wasn't having very good matches. You just look at the quality of guys he was in there with. And he did lose a lot. Although normally he would get screwed. Very rarely did we see Undertaker eat a clean pin. When he would lose, somebody would screw him. There was nobody who was screwed over more in the mid-90s than The Undertaker was. I'm sorry to Bret Hart, but I can remember, you know, this guy was always getting screwed by somebody, and somebody was stealing the urn and hitting him in the head with the urn and, you know, just fucking him over left and right. But it would always be, you know, interference and somebody hit him with a foreign object or something like that. Bray just, I call him the eater of pins for a reason. There's a reason I started calling him that all that time ago. And it sort of stuck. I know a lot of you call him that now too, because he just loses. He goes out there, he talks a big talk, he cuts these spooky promos, and you know, and then he goes out there and he doesn't deliver. He fails to deliver. And that has always been the problem with this Bray Wyatt character and trying to take him seriously. Now, I do blame him for this. We had heard a long time ago, and maybe it was a false report, but my understanding is that Bray writes his own promos, or at least has a lot of input. He has a hand in the writing of them and the final product that we see on TV every single week. Now, his delivery is fine. He can deliver a spooky promo, but we've heard the same promo from this guy now for at least the last 2 years. I feel like we have heard the same promo from him for years. Now, if he's writing his own material, whose fault is that? Can't blame the company. So it goes both ways. The booking has done him no favors. Absolutely. But if the guy is writing his own material, I've been tuning Bray Wyatt out now for months. Months! I try to tune him out. I half pay attention to what he says when he comes on TV. It's the same shit. Every single week. You know, it's the same stuff over and over and over again. It feels like nothing ever changes. He never has anything really interesting to say. And so you got to put the blame where the blame belongs. If he's writing his own content, then you know what? It's time for him to either start asking for input from someone else or just try to come up with some new ideas. I was going to say it's time to let WWE start scripting him, but I wouldn't go that far. I would never say that. That would make things even worse. That would make things, I feel, even worse if, in fact, they were scripting him the way they do everybody else. I don't think they are. So, to answer your question, it goes both ways. You blame WWE, you blame Bray. Bray's got to take some responsibility for this as well. You can't blame this all on WWE. But did they, you know, mishandle the character and make him out to be a complete joke? Somebody who would go out there and talk a big talk and never back up what he would go out there and talk about? Of course, you can't take somebody like that seriously. If I go out there on TV every single week, I don't care if I'm the spookiest looking, creepiest looking, most intimidating person in the world, and I go out there on TV every single week and I talk about how I'm going to beat your ass, I'm going to make you disappear, I'm going to make you wish you were never born. Like, I go out there, I talk a big talk, and then I go out there and I get my ass handed to me, and I get pinned 1, 2, 3. Every single week. And every now and then, I'll get a nice little token win here and there. But in the end, you know that when I walk out there, I'm probably taking the L. You're not going to take me seriously. You're not going to want to see me when I come out on television. I'm not must-see. I'm just another guy. And that, to me, was the biggest mistake they made. Somebody like Bray Wyatt should never have been just another guy. I was going to call it in here, but what the hell, we'll do a few more. Drew from L.A., I know the original plan for WrestleMania 13 was a rematch between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels before Shawn lost his smile. What confuses me about that is Austin won the Royal Rumble in 97 when the plan was still for Shawn against Bret, and the booking of that Rumble made it seem like they were going to continue with Austin and Bret for a little bit longer. It makes me wonder why Austin won that Rumble and what his original plan was for WrestleMania before Shawn messed all those plans up. Can you shed any light on this? Yes, I can, in fact. So, the belief was, and this is certainly what Bret believed to be true at the time, was that he would be wrestling Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 13, and Shawn would do the honors for Bret the way that Bret did the honors for Shawn the year before. Now, I've heard two different versions of what happened, or of what was supposed to happen. Austin was always going to win the Royal Rumble match the way he did. And because he cheated, it was always meant to set up that Final Four match at the February pay-per-view. Originally, the purpose of the Final Four was to determine a number one contender to challenge for the championship at WrestleMania. Bret would win, he would wrestle Shawn, and Undertaker would wrestle Sid underneath. What I believe to be the real story is that plans changed for Bret against Shawn to be for the championship at WrestleMania. And instead, Shawn, who had just won the belt back from Sid at the Rumble, was going to drop the belt back to Sid on that Thursday Raw, Thursday Live show, which is where Shawn ended up vacating it. And Final Four would then have included Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, The Undertaker, and Steve Austin. And Undertaker would win. Undertaker would win. That would set him up to challenge Sid for the title, and Bret against Shawn would be the other main event, but it would be non-title. So that's what I think was actually the sort of amended plan that was going to happen. Instead, Shawn didn't want to drop the belt to Sid. So he lost his smile. He got a boo-boo on his knee. He gave up the belt instead of losing it to Sid. Suddenly, the four-way match became a championship match because the title was vacant. But they still wanted to get to their destination of Undertaker and Sid for the title. So Bret won the belt for all of 24 hours. Sid got it back from him the next night, and I guess because Undertaker was the last person eliminated in the Final Four, he suddenly ended up as being the number one contender. It's all very convoluted, but that's the version that I believe to be true, okay, which is that Vince changed his mind on Bret and Shawn being a championship match, and instead he felt that Undertaker and Sid needed it more. Bret and Shawn didn't need the belt, Undertaker and Sid did. I still have the WWF magazine that came out around that time that previewed WrestleMania that year. It was a black cover. It had the WrestleMania 13 logo right in the middle, and it had four heads, which sounds kind of creepy, but it had four heads kind of circling around the WrestleMania logo. And the four faces were Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Undertaker, and Psycho Sid. So those four were absolutely going to be part of the top two matches at WrestleMania. At least as of a couple of months before when that magazine was probably first put together. The way things ended up, though, boy, did Steve Austin luck out, huh? You asked, you know, what was the plan for Austin? The plan was never for him to wrestle Bret Hart. It was that Austin was, and this has always been my understanding, is that Austin was going to have a singles match with the British Bulldog at WrestleMania. I think they even set some stuff up on TV with Austin and Bulldog about a month or so before the Royal Rumble, and then it just sort of got dropped, which may have been around the time that plans started to change. Who's to say that a Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels match would not have been as good or better than the match we got with Bret Hart and Steve Austin, but I'm pretty happy with the way things turned out. Dire Mood from Dublin, Ireland. Could you talk about the incident at the bar the night before WrestleMania 8 involving Shane McMahon, Bret Hart, and Julie Hart? Well, Bret tells the story in his book. They were all at the... I love these old stories, by the way. It's far more interesting than what goes on in this company today. So they were all at the bar the night before WrestleMania. Shane is there. He had been refereeing, and he was working on the ring crew at the time, and... In fact, if you go back and you watch the part of the Macho Man Ric Flair match from WrestleMania when Elizabeth comes out, like in a panic, she's coming out to the ring, and all the referees and all the officials are coming out with her, trying to get her to go back. Shane is one of the referees who tries, unsuccessfully, to convince Elizabeth to go back to the dressing room. So anyway, they're in the bar, Shane comes over to say hello to Bret, and Julie starts acting all weird. And Bret tells Shane, hey, you know, let me introduce you to my wife. And Shane's face just turns red as a tomato. Bret has no idea what's going on. And one of Bret's friends is with him that night. I don't know if it was a wrestler or who it was, but he tells Bret, you know, after Shane walks away, he fills Bret in on what's going on. He says that, you know, Shane grabbed her ass earlier. Or he came onto her in some way. I think he grabbed her ass, but like he came onto her in some way. So when Shane realized that it was Bret's wife, he obviously, you know, turned red and got really scared. Shane goes to the other end of the bar. He gets as far away from them as he can get. Bret looks over. He can see Shane staring back at him. He can see Shane kind of staring him down. And Bret gets really angry, thinking that, boy, you know, this kid must think he's bulletproof here. Like, you know, I won't do anything to him because he's Vince's son. I got to teach him a lesson. So he walks all the way to the other end of the bar. He grabs Shane. He throws him up against a wall. And he threatens to kick his ass if he ever touches his wife again. And I think in the book he even says he was never actually going to kick Shane's ass. He just wanted to sort of scare him and show him that, look, I don't care who you are. You can't be pulling that stuff. So I think he proved his point, though, a few years later when he punched his dad in the face that he just doesn't care. And if you get on Brett's bad side and you betray him in some way, you will pay the price for it. David from Westland, Michigan. What was the reason for Johnny B. Badd's departure from WCW? I heard he was uncomfortable with the angle with Kimberly Page. Is this true, or was there more to the story? I mean, that was a small part of it. Not really the reason he left, I guess. So Mero was a religious guy. He's pretty religious. Didn't really want to keep things going where he would be together with Kimberly as an act. Kind of reminds me of Ted DiBiase Jr. The whole thing with him and Maurice was just, there was no chemistry there at all. And a big part of that apparently was the fact that DiBiase is a very religious man, and he's married and has a family, and he just was never comfortable. He was never comfortable having Maurice with him as his valet. And you could tell he wasn't into the role because it just didn't work. There was nothing there, and so the whole thing flopped. So I guess it's kind of a similar deal here where everybody seemed to, you know, like them together, and they were a good combo, and he didn't really feel comfortable with it. But that wasn't the reason that he left. The real reason is he had a disagreement with Eric Bischoff, and WWE offered him a great deal. So he took it. They offered him guaranteed money. They agreed to fly his wife with him wherever he goes. That was one of his conditions. And of course, you know, once Vince took one look at her, he put her on TV, and she became a bigger star than Mero did, and their marriage ended. What's kind of funny, I guess it's not funny, but it is. What's funny about that is the whole reason that Mero even asked to have them pay to fly his wife everywhere with him, and this is according to him, was because he specifically did not want his marriage to end, like a lot of the other wrestlers' marriages ended, because they were away from their wives so much. He figured that if she could travel with him, their marriage would last. Oops. The best laid plans, I guess, right? And we'll do one more here. Steve from Virginia, buy or sell? Chris Jericho versus Kenny Omega at Wrestle Kingdom, or Johnny Gargano versus Andrade Cien Almas from NXT TakeOver Philadelphia? I am going to buy on Gargano and Almas. I'm going to sell on Jericho and Omega. And I love Jericho and Omega. That was my match of the year up until NXT TakeOver in Philly. To me, Johnny Gargano and Andrade Cien Almas, that was the best NXT match in history. I don't see how you can call it the best NXT match in history and not have that be your match of the year so far, unless you're into some of those other New Japan matches, which is fine, I guess. There's been quite a number of great New Japan matches already this year. Jericho Omega is on my list, probably number two. I can't put that ahead of the NXT match, though. I love that match too much. There was just the match itself, the story behind it, even right down to Candice running in and that whole sequence. And I mean, I guess you could say the only thing that would have made it perfect was to give Gargano the storybook ending and give him the big win. But yeah, I was okay with that. I actually wanted Almas to retain because I would have been bummed. The guy has had this rebirth, and it would have been too soon, I think, to take the championship off of him. But that was a fantastic match. I can't sell on that. So it's a tough choice, but I pick NXT over Wrestle Kingdom in terms of those two matches. All right, let's wrap things up there because that's a lot of mailbag questions. So keep sending them on in. The Solid Monster @gmail.com, current questions, classic questions. They are all welcome, and I will try to get to as many of them as I can. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle on there. I am also looking forward to going through some of these Coliseum video releases that are up on the network now. There's just a whole page of them now, and I don't know if I may, you know, review some of them. It's an idea that I've had. I haven't had time to really watch a whole lot of stuff this weekend. I've been working on the show and doing other stuff. I have to catch up on some of those New Japan matches. So I am way behind. Plus, somebody who had seen my Cloverfield review thought that I would be interested in this other movie that I've never seen called Pacific Rim, which I guess came out a number of years ago. And they said to me, oh, if you like the whole monster movie thing, kaiju, whatever, you'll enjoy this. So I'd never heard of it before. Apparently this movie came out like, I don't know, five years ago or something. I've never seen it. It's called Pacific Rim. I want to watch that. It's not enough hours in the day for all of this stuff, but hopefully I'll get to some of that later. And we'll be back with a brand new episode next Sunday. That will be episode 535. So we'll do 535 next weekend. We'll cover all the latest news and your questions. As always, leave a review in iTunes or Stitcher. We are a 5-star rated podcast. I appreciate all the positive feedback. And I will see you guys back here for a brand new show next weekend. That's it. I'm done. I'm out. Peace.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face.
Oh, oh my God. What do they think this is, Shakespeare? I was driving yesterday and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane. I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me.
Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.